on mortgage lending practices specifically, just the general topic. As you know, we've been trying to address this issue with the help of the governor's task force working on mortgage foreclosure consultants, loan originators, and a wide variety of topics for sure. Lending practices was something that did not really get addressed specifically in the task force. I know their intention is to continue to work on this program, and but I thought it was important that we have an informational hearing for our House members as well as the general public to discuss these issues just generally, and to look at possible positions on certain topics and concepts. And I really would like Corey Streisinger from DCBS to come up and give us that short overview of the process that the governor's task force has gone through, and where we're at, and just that general overview, if you wouldn't mind, Corey. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and happy to be here to talk about lending practices. We've been spending a lot of time talking about various aspects of mortgage lending today, but also over the last few months. And last fall, when the mortgage lending situation became particularly acute, the governor asked our department to take a number of steps to help Oregonians facing problems in mortgage lending, a number of steps that we can take administratively, for example, increasing enforcement and cracking down on misleading advertising. But he also asked us to form a work group to look at some of the issues that needed legislative attention. That work group has been meeting for the past several months, and a number of products have come out of that, reflected in two bills, as you know, one of them dealing with enforcement, which was heard on the, which was discussed with some senators in a non-hearing this morning, and another one which deals with mortgage rescue and foreclosure notices, which you heard this afternoon. And we also, in that work group, focused or have had some discussion, but limited discussion, of lending practices. We believe that focusing on foreclosure issues first was top priority because we have a lot of people in problem loans today, and we need to address their situation as they face possible foreclosure. We're committed, and the governor's committed, to addressing lending practices issues. We believe firmly that prepayment penalties should be limited, that loans should be based on an ability to pay the actual amounts due under the loan, not just an introductory teaser rate. We believe that disclosure should be thorough so that people know the terms of the loans that they're getting. We believe that people who qualify for a prime loan should be offered a prime loan rather than just a subprime loan. Those are all very important concepts to us. We also believe that it's very important to Oregonians, including Oregonians of limited credit and modest means, to have the ability to buy and finance a home. So we believe that a strong mortgage lending industry is important for Oregon as well. So in looking at some of these issues of lending practices, we've been interested in having strong protections for Oregonians, but also practices that allow us to have a strong mortgage lending industry. And these are complex issues, so we've been very concerned that the details are reflected in appropriately in legislation that you develop. So happy to be here to continue these discussions. A lot of the what we view as critical concepts are reflected in the bills that you are considering. But on the other hand, we also understand that they are complex, and we're happy to help offer whatever comments we can on language and issues that may arise. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Corey. I was wondering if you could elaborate just briefly on, I guess, the financial environment right now as we see it, and, you know, always, you know, from last session we heard the market will correct itself and we'll take care of this problem. And so right now I'm wondering about credit availability, are loan products disappearing, and, you know, always I know there's a balance in creating these kind of regulations that the governor supports, and I think many members of the legislature would like to also see happen. But how sensitive is that to interfering with the availability of loan products that are out there, or is there a correlation?
Well, I can offer you my perspective, and of course there'll be others in the room who will offer their perspectives. We have seen a significant change in lending practices actually over the last several years, and then again over the last 6 months. A lot of the types of non-traditional loan products that we've heard a lot about over the last few months really didn't exist 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. But in that window, a lot of non-traditional lending products have been developed and have been on the market, low documentation loans, loans that have initial teaser rates and optional interest, optional types of payments that involve you sometimes paying interest only, sometimes not even paying the interest fully so that the loan has a negative amortization feature. A lot of those loans were offered based on, as we're now finding, a limited assessment of the borrower's ability to repay, and that's been a phenomenon nationally, and we've all seen the consequences of that. A lot of these loans were sold, repackaged on the securities market in collateralized mortgage obligations, and then foreclosure started as the real estate market started to cool off in some parts of the country. As interest rates, then teaser rates ran out, adjustable interest rates adjusted, people started facing foreclosure, and the credit markets reacted sharply to that, to the extent that the subprime lending market is virtually unavailable today because the third-party financiers who have been providing the capital for these types of loans have switched all the way over from an immense appetite for these loans to no appetite for these loans. So lenders are making loans with their own capital, but the ability to access capital markets for anything other than good credit is pretty much non-existent now. Prime loans are definitely available, and in fact, lenders are anxious to talk to people with good credit because that's what they sell is loans. But for people with subprime credit, the options are fairly limited right now. And we are seeing people who have entered into these non-traditional products over the last couple of years are going to, particularly in 2008, we're expecting to see a lot of interest rates adjust. Now, the Fed has recently lowered interest rates, and that will help some because, for example, a number of these adjustable rate mortgages are tied to indexes like LIBOR, the London Interbank offering rate, and LIBOR has come down by, I think, around 100 basis points over the past several months. So that does help in that when these loans adjust, they won't necessarily adjust as high, but the adjustment will still be there and the rate shock will still be there. And the options for people with challenged credit or limited assets to refinance right now is not very good. One of the concerns we have, of course, is that we do want to make sure that people who are in that situation and have the right now maybe some ability to refinance, it's good for them to have that ability to refinance. And we want to make sure that during this challenging period, as well as for the future, we do have loan options available. On the other hand, I personally believe that although the market right now has limited and a lot of the loan products that created this problem aren't being offered today, I think as the memories fade, the capital appetite will come back. And I certainly wouldn't say that we don't need to worry about these lending practices anymore. I think we do need to worry about these lending practices for the future so that when the market swings back and the capital becomes available for residential lending, we don't see the same types of problems recur in the future.
Thank you, Corey. Short, you actually answered my next question in that answer, which was, you know, short of government regulation, even though the market's corrected itself in some regards to not offering some of these loan products that have gotten us into this situation with a lot of foreclosures, that could come back with if, in fact, there's no regulation to put parameters around that.
It certainly could, Mr. Chair. It's getting attention at the federal level as well as the state level, and I think the general feeling is it's better to have a good solid floor under lending practices for the future.
Thank you. I think that was a pretty good brief summary of the situation we're looking at and where the legislature is and where the task force is, I think, and looking at these issues. And if any committee members at this point have questions for Corey at this time to help kick off this conversation, feel free to ask those. Any questions?
I just have one.
Representative Nelson. Just one. Tonight, you just have one? That's interesting. Okay.
I'm being very quiet. thank you, Mr. Chair and Corey. Should there be some type of... what's the word? Remonstrance. That's not a good word. But for these lenders who know darn well when they're writing, you know, a loan, that this borrower is going to be in trouble. I mean, I think there are too many of them that, you know, decide to help somebody get into a home and know full well that this home is overpriced for, the, you know, their capability to repay it. I mean, should there be some kind of, what's the word?
Penalty.
Penalty? Yeah, good word.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we do think that there should be some requirement to assess ability to repay. The question is what the shape of that requirement should be. But I think many lenders, and you'll undoubtedly hear from some of them, absolutely do assess their borrower's ability to repay, and the first thing they want to do is to make sure that that borrower is in a loan that's suitable for them. But unfortunately, we've also seen some lending practices which don't meet those standards over the past few years, and that's what brings us here today.
Mr. Chair. One half of a question.
Oh, this is still part of the first question?
Yes.
Follow up, please.
I was just wondering if you have an idea of what that should be, that penalty.
Mr. Chair.
Or how it should be adapted.
I don't have a particular solution to put on in front of you today.
And would you know of any, and?
Follow up, please.
And would you know of any other state that has this in place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, there are a number of states that have various types of ability to pay requirements or standards in their law. For a lot of the types of standards that apply to lending institutions, the enforcement of those is through civil enforcement through our department. That is, we have the ability to take enforcement action and to assess penalties against lenders that break the law.
Thank you. Further questions of Ms. Reisinger? Thank you, Corey, for opening up this dialogue for us. I appreciate that and appreciate the work you're doing in your capacity at DCBS. And speaking of these topics generally, I see a lot of people signing up in opposition and for and all that, but I'm not really going to get into what they're for and against, but perhaps they can tell us on specific concepts what they're in favor of and what they're not in favor of. So first up, I'd like to call up Bobby Walker and Mark Peterson. And to be fair, this isn't that they're on the same side or have the same perspective or anything. They're just trying to call them up at the same time. Mm-hmm. Well, it's some kind of open up. Good evening, gentlemen. I appreciate you making for some yet another appearance, you know, to talk about this subject matter. I know you've been in front of committees before on similar topics. And as you know, we've had this task force, as Ms. Streisinger has laid out, but as well, I'm sure you're aware that there are proposals around lending practices in the legislature, and so it's it helps to get this informational meeting out there about these concepts specifically. So appreciate you showing up and giving us 2 cents worth, or dime, or you know, maybe it's a dollar. I don't know. As the eye of the beholder. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be here for us. Thank you.
You betcha.
So introduce yourself for the record.
All righty. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Westland and Representatives Bobby Walker. I'm from Albany, Oregon, obviously, and branch manager for Pathfinder's Mortgage there.
Thank you.
And thank you for the opportunity. Indeed. Looking at the unedited draft, it looks like a lot of changes that I wasn't privy to, but I think I'll just put it in a nutshell. Some of the things that bother me about the way that it stood as of last Friday. There you go.
All right.
Hearing better now?
Yes.
Some of the things that bothered me about the bill as it stood last Friday was as I go through section by section, so many of while every section basically is already covered by federal law with some changes, the Homeowners Equity and Preservation Act, HOPA, and the Truth in Lending Act. And as I go through those, it's rather redundant seeing what is already there. Now, there are some things, some items in there, like Section 5, the part about appraisals and coercion. Of course, the coercion part, when you talk to the appraisal board, there are penalties for the appraisers if they are coerced and it's found out. There are very stiff penalties for the appraiser.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Bobby, yeah. just for a minute. I know I know you're talking about a particular bill that's been introduced on the Senate side.
It has
general concepts around it, but we're really not here to look at that bill line by line.
Okay.
I'd really like to talk about the concepts that may be in that bill specifically, and we can get to the line by line stuff. Will I'm sure happen in a future committee meeting. Uh-huh. Right now, we're trying to gather information about those general concepts that may be in that bill, may be in other bills, specifically about what do we do about lending practices specifically. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at here, is getting the input from people on the general concepts of lending practices, whether it be prepayment penalties, whether it be the yield spread premium, whether it be the ability to pay, as some of those topics have come up, and I think might be addressed in those in that bill, and certainly we can talk about those concepts that are in that bill too. But I really didn't want to go through a line by line version of that bill at this point,
mm-hmm.
Because I haven't had time to look at the bill myself personally.
Okay.
And I know it's had several amendments, and so if you could just kind of frame it that way, you can still talk about those same specifics. But
sure.
Does that make sense, Bobby?
How about if I'll cut to the chase then, and I'll give my recommendation as to what I would like to see happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When one does a reverse mortgage, it's required that they have pre-counseling. They typically call up a third party, and they speak for 45 minutes to an hour. Before the loan can be registered, there is a number that is given to that customer, and it is applied to the application, thus telling everyone they've gone through the counseling. That counseling tells the borrower what they're going to expect and what they're going to go through. I would suggest a similar situation for high-risk loans. In other words, pay option ARMs, although in the subprime world, subprime is dead and pay option ARMs are gone, but there are still adjustable rate mortgages. I would consider those potentially a high-risk loan. So along with the counseling, I would take one step further. When one goes to closing at a title company, I would suggest that from the lender, an underwriter or a doc drawer be available by phone so that in the presence of the title company representative, loan officer, if he's there, the borrower, the lender can ask these questions. If there's a prepayment penalty, she explains those, yes.
No.
All on through the loan, the adjustable rate mortgage. She could say, okay, I see this is a two-year ARM. Have you considered the consequences and what your payment will be and the affordability of such after 2 years? All this would be recorded. At that point, if the borrower did not understand, then they could walk away from the loan, or the loan could be amended. But either way, it would be recorded, it would end all ambiguity, and it would put to death so many of these issues right here and now. I'm for, really, instead of cutting off the tail of the snake, going after the head. If the manufacturer of a car that is a bad model has a problem, you don't go to the salesman, you go to the manufacturer. And I'm saying bringing the lender into the final closing in that last 15 minutes and making sure that borrower understands what they're getting into. It's recorded, and then no one can say, well, I didn't understand. I didn't know. It's recorded. It's right there. That's what I would suggest in a nutshell that needs to be there. And that is not there in any of these practices today.
Concept I hadn't considered. Questions? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I do have a question. You're talking about bringing people in the last part of a closing. Did I misunderstand that? Or
the first part would be the pre-counsel that is already in place for reverse mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, I understand that. I just went through that with my mother.
That would be there. But the final close is where all the details are gone through. And these dear people have to go through a ream of paper in a short period of time.
Okay.
And I just think it'd be prudent that the lender would be on hand to explain just the nuances of the loan, the features that could put them at risk.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Okay. Then I did kind of understand that. You're talking about right at the end of the closing, at the last part of the closing, you go through all these documents, correct?
Well, they go through the documents, but there's going to be salient features of the loan, the highlights, the things that can cause damage.
I'm well aware of that.
Right.
What I'm getting to is this.
Uh-huh.
What happens if I get to the end of a contractual agreement and I find something in this loan I don't want? What about the contract if this wasn't brought up front?
Well, it should have been brought up front in the counseling.
So what you're saying is the counseling then bring in documentation at the end of at the closing?
No, the counseling is what allows the beginning. It tells the people this is the kind of loan that you're getting into.
Right.
At the end, it just solidifies it and makes certain, and it's, their voice is recorded, and they are on the record saying, yes, I understand.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici had her hand up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I know she's your favorite.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. I have a question about the counseling. I'd like to know the source of that requirement, but more importantly, I'd like to know who ends up paying for the cost of that counseling.
The lender.
And that's required by?
FHA. I mean, it's Fannie Mae. It's required.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was it Bob Walker? Is that
mm-hmm.
your name? And where are you from?
Albany.
And what do you do?
I'm a branch manager for Pathfinder's Mortgage.
I'm sorry?
Branch manager for Pathfinder's Mortgage.
Pathfinder's Mortgage.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you. do you know anywhere in the country that this practice is done?
I don't, but I can tell you that I go to all of my closings.
I'm sorry.
I can tell you that I go to all of my closings, and I know it's not done in any of mine.
But any other state?
I don't.
You don't know?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Walker? Not seeing any. I really appreciate your thoughts on that. As you know, I think that pre-counseling for people is really something to consider.
I have a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Westland.
I like it.
Thank you.
I'm short, I'm succinct, I'm to the point.
Appreciate that, Senator Westland.
And then lets us all know it.
Mr. Chair, I know that the similar concept was tried in Illinois, especially in Cook County, Illinois. And it was discontinued. I don't know why, but it would be interesting to find out what the problems were with it and why it was discontinued.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel.
I believe, though, he was specifically speaking of what we call in the industry B-money, which is a subprime type loan. Those are the only people you were speaking about, the high-risk subprime loan.
I would even include, just for those high-risk types of loans, prime borrowers.
You mean like no-doc, those kinds of loans?
As of today, I had just no doc loans. They're virtually non-existent.
That's correct.
Stated income loans as of today, lenders have, they're done. There's just a handful that have them.
But 4 years ago, you could get them a dime a dozen.
Oh, a nickel a dozen.
Yeah.
You bet.
And I think you also stated that, you know, you would consider this as a good option for all adjustable rate mortgages.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Because I've just had too many people that come in that they get into contracts. I had one gentleman, 9 3/4 on a loan.
Yeah.
It's an arm. Before his arm even adjusted, he couldn't pay for
it. Well, sometimes arms are sometimes referred to as fixed rate, and that's always been, I guess, I haven't really liked that concept that an arm could be fixed rate. So.
Oh, indeed, but I think that's where the counseling and that last-minute phone call might put an end to a lot of that.
Yeah. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wanted to ask you, do you not believe that the mortgage lender has a fiduciary responsibility to be certain that the borrower can actually pay? You believe that if they say they can pay, that's good enough?
Not at all, sir.
But that's follow-up?
Follow-up.
But that's kind of what I heard you say. We get them on record. We get their voice on record saying they understand, and that seems to be the point of this, is to get them on record saying they understand to relieve you of your responsibility.
No, it's to put everybody at the same level. Everybody is at the same level if they all understand. You know, many, many times someone could go in and, for example,
mm-hmm.
say they're going to purchase a 2-year arm, and the thought is, okay, with that 2-year arm, you're going to be in a different place in 2 years, a better place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps they know that they may not be. Or, of course, they don't know what the future holds.
And neither do you.
No, but at the time of doing the loan, of course, we look at everything to make certain that they can pay for it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You betcha.
Thank you. I'd like Senator Westland.
I think it's interesting the different perspective from Representative Riley, what he was hearing and what I was hearing.
Thank you.
And I think there's some valid points on both sides of this, but what I was hearing is not only does the broker, the loan originator, have the responsibility to disclose this at the time, you know, the documents are being created, but then at the time of closing, you know, there's a reaffirmation of what was already said. I don't see it so much as getting the borrower, you know, on the hook. Yeah, okay, you said you understand this. It's the lender is also saying this is what it is on the record. Correct me if that's a misinterpretation.
No ambiguities. I think to have it perfectly clear. So everybody knows what kind of contract they're going into at that point. It's their time to back out.
So, Mr. Chair, may I?
Representative Riley, another comment?
Yes, thank you. No, I fully understood that. But that doesn't, in my mind, do anything except say the borrower says, I understand what I'm getting into. That doesn't, if I say to my doctor, I know what I'm getting into here, so you don't have to worry about it. They still better worry about it. And this is, in my opinion, this is exactly the same situation. My doctor had a medical responsibility. A lender has a fiduciary responsibility to that client, and that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, right. Representative Riley, I'm not trying to assuage that in any manner at all.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, and I'm sure that wasn't aimed at Senator Bates at all. So
it was too.
Thank you, Mr. Walker, for your effort. And I'd like to keep this moving. We've got a long list of people, and we could probably get caught up talking amongst ourselves into one person for quite some time. So,
shouldn't we call Dr. Bates?
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, and good afternoon. My name is
please identify yourself for the record. I know you were going to do it anyway.
Yep. But my name is Mark Peterson. I reside in Eugene, Oregon. I've been a mortgage broker for 15 years and a mortgage company owner for the last 8 years. My company employs 15 people in total, including myself. I'm going to consolidate what I had to say in light of this being an informational session. I provided a handout that I'll get to at the end, but just want to say in the beginning that I do agree what was said earlier in that we do need to protect the future from some of these types of loans that got us into this problem, but it was also mentioned that the vast majority of these loans are gone today. So I think we can protect the future, but we also need to make sure we protect the availability of credit to ensure that homeowners and purchasers can still pursue financing as needed, whether it's to offset foreclosure or to continue to purchase a home. So I think I wanted to make that point. Additionally, I think we really, in my opinion, we should focus legislation on getting the bad actors out of this industry. There's bad actors in every industry, and I think it'd be a tragedy if we went around this in a different way and eliminated credit for a lot of people that otherwise would deserve it. And so I would be in favor of legislation that would help reduce bad actors in our industry. And I think the governor's work group is a good way to approach that. Just a comment about fiduciary responsibility. You know, the role of a mortgage broker, quite literally, is just to marry a client to a lender. And I believe that the lender's underwriters are the ones that are responsible for the ultimate decision with regards to whether or not that borrower is going to be able to make that payment or not. We as mortgage brokers will do our best to marry that particular client with those underwriting guidelines, but I don't think that the responsibility ultimately falls on us. We're just the broker. The true definition is a mortgage broker. We're going to broker this client to this underwriter, and I think at that point the underwriter is the one that needs to be responsible for making that ultimate decision. So our job, again, is just to marry a client with a loan product, and then the lender, it's their loan. They're the ones that have the ultimate responsibility of making sure that the client has the ability to pay. Now, obviously, we as mortgage brokers, a good mortgage broker is going to identify whether or not that client is going to have the ability to pay so that as professionals, that client gets that loan. And so, but ultimately, I think the underwriters are the ones that will be the ultimate decision maker on their ability to pay. What I provided to you guys, and being that this is an informational session, I wanted to bring a perspective with regards to what options are available to mortgage brokers if legislation is so unkind to our industry that we decide to make a change. There are mortgage bankers out there, mortgage banks that exist only to create net branch banks out of mortgage brokers such as myself. I get offers all the time to become a mortgage net branch bank. And I brought in just one of many, many, many that are on the internet. If you just Google mortgage broker net branch, you'll find tons of advertisements. Anyway, what I provided you states that and this industry is booming because mortgage brokers are abandoning the broker concept in light of harsh legislation. So anyway, just wanted to make a few couple points here. Number two, turnkey solution. It's literally an overnight scenario where I would unfortunately not be self-employed anymore, but my company could continue to operate under the same name, albeit it would be a DBA registered under the bank. And I would be my personnel, my location, my operations would all remain the same. The general public would not know that I'm now a net branch bank. I underlined on number three that They as a bank, they offer 100% origination fees and yield spread premiums net after expenses, and that's how it works. This is an important point to make because banks still have yield spread premium, even though they're not required to disclose it. It's there, whether it's called a service release premium. It's a release premium when they sell a loan. As brokers, we sell it immediately, so our yield spread premium is at the time of sale. Banks may hold on to their loan for some time before they release that service, and then they get their premium. But nonetheless, as number four states, they're bragging about non-disclosure of yield spread premium. Specifically, not having disclosed yield spread premiums is a major advantage of mortgage banking versus strictly brokering. Mm-hmm. So some points that I put down on the bottom of that page, if all brokers became net branch bankers, the state loses ability to regulate because we're all bankers. And with the ease of this transition, that is a very likely scenario. It keeps me sleeping at night. If legislation was so detrimental to our industry, I know I've got a backup plan. Now, I don't want to do this. I do want to see well thought out, smart legislation that removes the bad actors out of our industry. But what I don't want to see is my dream of continuing being an entrepreneur and an employer, which has been 8 years now, and I don't want to see the Oregon consumer hurt with the loss of the product availability that we as brokers bring. Number two, why do banks do this? Well, banks will receive, on average, $500 per transaction that my office originates. And literally what will happen is we'll just pass that on to the Oregon consumer. So literally the Oregon consumer will pay $500 more in costs for a bank-originated loan versus a broker-originated loan, because I've got to give some profit margin back to the bank for originating loans under their license. So this increases the cost of the Oregon consumer by about $500 as compared to now. This also hurts the Oregon economy because large amounts of revenue is sent out of state. In this case, it's Texas. This money would be flowing to Texas. Number three, many small business owners are put out of business and their employees become employees of out-of-state corporations. So what I wanted to do is just bring that perspective to this informational meeting and saying that, this is an unanticipated consequence of what bad legislation would result in, and ultimately we're here to pass legislation to protect the Oregon consumer and protect the Oregon economy. And so I hope it doesn't come to that, but I haven't read the new amendments to SB 1090, but the original tent version of 1090 had a lot of, in my opinion, problems with that would cause me to do this. And so I'm done, so if I have questions, I'm...
Hey, maybe you can clarify something for me when, in speaking of the yield spread premiums versus the service release premiums that the mortgage bankers use, but not the mortgage brokers use the yield spread premiums. Mortgage bankers use the service release premiums. Is that, have I got that straight?
It's all cloaked under the same concept.
Right. Yeah. So have you looked at the proposals that the Federal Reserve has come out with around yield spread premiums that came out this winter that are out for consideration? Looks like, all the Federal Reserve Board voted unanimously this is what needs to happen. And if you have looked at that, does that also address the service release premiums? And is that something that the feds regulate, service release premiums? Does the state have the ability to regulate? Maybe you're not the right person to ask that question, but maybe you might shed some light on that from your perspective.
Well, what I can say is obviously, the state can't legislate the banks, and so they're going to be unaffected by, state regulation. So I have read with regards to what is proposed federally in that the yield spread premium needs to be disclosed up front, and then at the time of closing, the yield spread premium cannot exceed what was disclosed to the consumer. the professionals in our industry are not afraid of disclosure. We're just afraid of the ability to use higher interest rates with yield spread premium attached to that to offset borrowers' closing costs. And there's many different scenarios when we use that. In fact, we use it every day because every loan has yield spread premium, and if we didn't have it, then the cost of that loan would go up accordingly by that same amount of yield spread premium that we're receiving. So every loan does benefit with yield spread premium. Now, banks, they have it. It's just whether they call it yield spread premium or service release premium or a margin premium, it's there. What they'll do is they'll originate a loan at the same interest rate that we originated at, but they'll hold on to it, whereas we sell it immediately. And when they do, when it comes time for them to sell that loan, then that interest rate will yield a spread according to whatever the market is paying at that time.
Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to
You're
come
welcome.
Out tonight. Appreciate it. And I want to thank you also because you just describing the mortgage broker's role in terms of kind of marrying a client with a loan product, and it's the underwriter's responsibility. Just using that analogy and that logic, it makes my job seem a lot easier because I have all kinds of people come to me with ideas for bills, and all I have to do is marry this idea that my client, my constituent wants with a bill, and then we get it passed, and it's up to the Senate or maybe the governor who has the real responsibility. So I feel like my job is a lot easier. I mean, my question is, I understand your point about the underwriter, but what responsibility do you have as a mortgage broker, aside from just simply, you know, getting a person a product? Is there any responsibility?
You know, that's a really interesting question because if I had no responsibility, I would not be, you know, in this competitive marketplace, I would be, I would lose out to my competition. If I had no responsibility and I sent a loan up to a lender, a bank, for them to underwrite, and I didn't do my job, they would not approve the loan. Consequently, the borrower would not get the loan, and you know, nobody's happy, whether it's the real estate or the client themselves. And so, in terms of responsibility, I truly believe that my job is to marry, and I like that analogy because I'm literally taking. See, the wholesale lenders, the investors, the banks that provide these loans, they don't have a retail outlet. We are the retail outlet. So literally, we're the field soldiers that just send the clients to them, and it's our job to make sure that that they'll underwrite it and they'll approve it. Otherwise, they won't allow us to. They'll cease their relationship with us if we don't send, you know, loans that they underwrite it and they approve it. So, you know, I really am under the opinion that as a mortgage broker, I'm a field soldier, taking borrowers to investors, and if I've done my job, which is just marrying the borrower's particular situation to the underwriter's guidelines, then that bank or that investor or that wholesale outlet will take that loan. But in terms of responsibility, if I don't act in a professional manner, then the competitive marketplace is going to remove me out of the business. And so now, if I was lending my own money, then I think the responsibility, the fiduciary responsibility, falls on me. But as a mortgage broker who simply is marrying a client to a set of underwriting guidelines, no, I do not believe that I have a legal responsibility for ensuring that borrower has the ability to pay.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think some of my question has been addressed, and I wanted to follow up on this a little bit. With Mr. Peterson, I'm trying to make consistent these two different images. You have this matchmaker image and then the field soldier image, and they aren't really coming together for me. So I have a an email from a constituent who's a mortgage broker. And this person says, we have an agency relationship by contract with wholesale lenders to which we broker loans and therefore cannot take on a fiduciary responsibility vis-a-vis a client because it results in a conflict of interest. So I wonder if you agree with that. Do you have some sort of contractual relationship with the lenders? That do you enter into a contract with the lenders that we will represent you in going out and selling your product?
We do have a contract with every lender in which we send clients to. That is correct. And we do, you know, that I will actually provide you a contract if you wish. I can't verbatim, you know, commit to what they say, but in essence, we will buy back the loan if we commit loan fraud. I think that's probably the, you know, the meat of the contract is that concept there. But, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, one more quick question. I know, you know, protecting the availability of credit and loan products was something you mentioned as being, you know, pretty important to the marketplace, and I don't think anybody would disagree with you on that. And one of the proposals, you know, from the Federal Reserve around this, and I'm sure in this legislature too, has to deal with prepayment penalties and putting limits on prepayment penalties. You know, some states have actually banned prepayment penalties because they see the you know, sometimes it just exacerbates a bad situation if it's timed incorrectly or it's really excessive, things like that. So in your opinion, would limits on prepayment penalties for certain time periods in a loan, in a particular loan, or allowing them sometimes but not other times, or allowing them on some loan products but not others, you know, given our current climate, do you think that that kind of action would actually limit the availability of credit?
Eliminating prepayment penalties, I do not think would limit the availability of credit. I personally do not think that the industry needs prepayment penalties.
So I guess I can take from that, if you think that eliminating them doesn't do it, limiting them wouldn't do it either.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll just be honest with that statement in that I just don't see really the need for it. Now, there may be a secondary market, you know, rationale behind it, but on the front end, I don't see any need for them.
Well, any other? Representative Riley.
Two questions, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Two questions you have.
Thank you. The first one is about this net branching. And one of the things that you said is you would like us to see rules and laws that eliminate bad actors. In your opinion, if we eliminate bad actors, are they going to become branch managers?
That's a great question. I think some of the ideas that have already been brought forth, like in last Friday's testimony, would be things like a brick and mortar concept where loan originators cannot work out of the basement of their house. There's a lot of issues with regards to privacy policy, you know, personal information being stored at somebody's home. So I think your bad actors may gravitate, and I tenderly walk on that line there because I'm sure there are good actors that are working out of their home too. But I think that allows for more of an opportunity for problems when there's a lack of a brick and mortar or a commercial office space.
Okay, that's good. And I do appreciate the way you've laid things out. I think you've done your homework and you've done a good job explaining some things to us. But one of the things, when I talk about a fiduciary responsibility for loan originators, one of the things I'm thinking about is the fact that you have multiple loans that you could apply for any individual. And one of the things that I see personally, and I want to know how you feel about it, as a fiduciary responsibility that I think you either have or should have, is to be sure that you apply for the best loan in the best interest of that client and not in the best interest of one of the banks that you have a contract with. What's your feeling about that?
I'm so glad that you asked that question, because in a competitive marketplace, if I don't act, as you will, in the best interest of the client in securing the best loan for them, I will likely lose that loan to a competitor. And so from that perspective, we will start with, and this is the way we operate, we'll start with the very best loans available and work our way down until that borrower finally gets a match. And so we do that because, quite literally, if we don't, somebody else will, and that borrower will go somewhere else with their business.
Thank you.
Senator Westland.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Just a quick observation. And, Mark, I've got to tell you, I will say this a lot more discreetly based on your answer to the prepayment interest issue. I very much appreciate that answer and your frankness and your honesty. So I will say this way, and that is, when you were asked the open-ended question is what is responsibility of a broker, your answer, open-ended answer, or your answer to that open-ended question was that it's to functionally hook the borrower up with the underwriter, the marrying function. I assume implicit in that is that responsibility of the broker is to explain to their clients what the loan also is.
Absolutely.
Is that a...
If I can expand on that answer, we pride ourselves in being consultants, not salespeople. And in so doing, we fully explain all aspects of the loan to the client. We provide three options to the client. The lowest interest rate that we have comes with the highest set of closing costs, a middle ground loan, and then a higher interest rate loan with the least amount of closing costs. We discuss those three options with the borrower's particular situation and come to a conclusion as which loan is best for them. And so, absolutely, we discuss every aspect of that because that builds trust with the client. And when we build trust with the client, they're less likely to go somewhere else.
Well, like I said, just
I really appreciate your comments and coming here. And you know, we do have quite a few people signed up, and we could probably spend most evening talking to the two of you, you know, elaborating on some of these concepts. Unless there's further questions of this panel, I'd like to bring up some others. I really appreciate your Representative Nelson, I almost missed you.
I know, your second favorite person up here.
I'm going to have to get my administrator to sit you on the right side of me.
Oh, not by Representative Gillum.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Right. Thank you. I just want to liven this place up a little bit. It's getting kind of dead. do you men have to carry liability insurance, Mr. Walker and Mr. Peterson? Or call it malpractice? What do you call it?
Well, the closest thing you could call it would be errors and omissions, and no, we're not required.
You're not required.
And if you look at, I've heard that thrown around rather loosely. If you look at the coverages that are available, they don't provide good coverage for either the mortgage company or the mortgage lender, and it's horrendously expensive, to the tune of around $3,000 per year just for one individual.
How much?
Around $3,000 per year.
Hmm. So, follow up, Mr. Chair, and do banks have this errors and omissions?
Well, you know, along with FDIC and all of those components, they have they're much more equipped with insurance that you're referring to. I can't speak of the specifics.
Okay, and another quick follow-up. Do you men have license to do business?
Absolutely.
What kind of license is it?
State of Oregon.
State of Oregon?
Uh-huh.
A mortgage broker's license.
Mortgage broker. And you have a mortgage broker license, too?
Right. Okay. Right, and also the state of Washington.
Okay.
The owners of the mortgage company have a license, and then each loan originator has a mortgage broker's license, a loan originator's license as well. And I think Representative Riley, to answer your question with bad actors, I was going to also state, in addition to brick and mortar, that and along with your question, Representative Nelson, increasing the surety, the bond requirement. I'm all in favor of you know, going up to $100,000. The current $25,000 bond doesn't give much recourse to the borrower. As professional organizations, we wouldn't have problems satisfying that requirement, nor you know, having issues with that amount, because we just wouldn't have an issue with it. So that would be another area on how to eliminate the bad actors.
Representative Esquivel.
I have one little question here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were stating that your loan officers, is that correct, are licensed by the state of Oregon?
Correct.
What kind of a license is this? Because I'm not familiar with any license for a loan officer. I know the brokerage has to be licensed.
Right.
And it's my understanding that a loan officer works underneath the brokerage's license itself.
Right.
But they individually have no ethics accountability, nor do they have a license that the state can jerk and put them out of business. Is that correct?
I'm glad you clarified that, because the owner has a license. The loan originators are registered, and they need to pass continuing education requirements every 2 years.
Looks like you're done. You're off the hook, off the hot seat with that last clarification. I really appreciate your input into this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up, I'm going to mix it up a little bit. I think I'd like to, let's see. What else do we have here? Can I bring up... let's see, Duke Shepherd and Charlene McGee.
Good evening. My name is Charlene McGee, and I'm president of the Portland NAACP branch. For years, people of color have been concerned with getting fair access to credit, particularly home loans. In 1977, Congress enacted a Community Reinvestment Act specifically to make home loans more affordable to people underserved by traditionally banking institutions, including women, African Americans, Latinos, rural residents, and low-wealth families. At that time, no one could have foreseen the growth and development of the subprime industry, which did not begin in any significant way until 20 years later. Now, members of our communities have access to credit, but most of it is abusive and does not lend itself to creating sustainable home ownership. In pursuit of the American dream and to build wealth, many have fallen victims to subprime loan transactions. Subprime loans are aggressively marketed to people with weak or limited credit, and there is strong evidence that lenders also target people of color, regardless of their credit history. At all income levels, African American and Hispanics were much more likely than whites to receive high-cost subprime loans in Oregon in 2006. For example, in Oregon, about half of African Americans and half middle-income borrowers receive subprime loans, compared to just 25% of white borrowers. In 1990, African American home ownership was 38%. By 2006, the home ownership rate among African Americans had decreased to 35%. Theoretically, the subprime market could serve to expand ownership and bring greater prosperity to underserved communities by establishing wealth. For borrowers with limited or impaired credit histories, a subprime loan could act as a bridge to prime financing. In reality, subprime lenders have made it difficult for families with subprime loans to improve their financial position. Today, the subprime market is poised to bring about the greatest drain of wealth within the African, Today, the subprime market is poised to bring about the greatest drain of wealth the African-American community has ever experienced. A new report titled Foreclosed, State of the Dream 2008, showed definitely that banks and other lending institutions trap blacks and Latinos in predatory lending schemes as a matter of policy. Key findings from the report. The subprime crisis has pulled a large chunk of wealth from many middle and lower income families and individuals in the form of home and home equity, a prime even sole asset for those without great wealth. The government has remained silent and inactive, but there are things that can be done. Secondly, a second finding was, it also established that the total loss of wealth for people of color should be between $164 billion and $213 billion for subprime loans taken during the past 8 years. We believe this represents the greater loss of wealth for communities of color in modern U.S. history. A third finding was that subprime loans among black and African-American borrowers will lose between $71 billion and $92 billion, while Latino borrowers will lose between $75 and $98 billion for the same period. Predatory mortgage lending is a blanket term for a variety of lending practices that strip wealth or income from borrowers. Characteristics of predatory loan may include, but are not limited to, these type of lending practices: stirring, prepaid penalties, flipping, yield spreads, premium, and ignoring ability to repay. We are at a pivotal point in history of subprime mortgage lending. We can either clean up the market or continue to allow people to grapple with illusory home ownership that ultimately sets them back. We can deliver on the true American dream of home ownership by ensuring that no one door is closed because of abusive lending practices. At this time, all the appropriate people are at the table. The Civil Rights and Advocacy Organization has spoken loud and clear that abusive mortgage lending is hurting communities of color. For instance, the National NAACP has called for an end to predatory mortgage lending practices and have also taken out class action lawsuits against several of these institutions. And in 2006, it reissued a resolution denouncing the abusiveness of these practices. The National Urban League recently demanded a federal home buyer's bill of rights, which calls for a right of people to be free from predatory lending. The Rainbow Push Coalition, the National Coalition of La Raza, and the Leadership Council on Civil Rights, too, have called for an end to these same practices. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony, and I think you could add to that list. From my understanding, the city of Baltimore, the city of Cleveland have also filed similar lawsuits on that. I appreciate that testimony.
Ready?
Senator Westland, you have a question
you'd
like to interject?
Is it possible to get a copy of your testimony? Because
sure.
That was very powerful.
I will clear that.
Yeah, I understand. You have no idea how many times all of us have sat there, scribbled notes in the back of the room, come to the witness stand, and...
But so you can relate.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
But we all want one.
Yeah.
Not just Senator Webb.
If I can get your contact information, I'll love to.
Yeah, you can get it to our committee administrator here, and the committee assistant there can give you the information if you need to leave.
I would like the original copy.
I want the original copy autographed. That's what I want.
So thank you so much for testifying anyway. Mr. Shepard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Duke Shepard. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And as we've looked at this issue, it seems we've got significant segments of an industry that are built on a business model of W.C. Fields quotes, never give a sucker an even break, and it's morally wrong to let a sucker keep his money. And we don't find those to be the compelling policy arguments for doing nothing. We find those to be the compelling arguments for doing something, if that's the way an industry is going to approach this. And it seems that home ownership and stability and upward mobility ought to be the guiding goals and principles of state policy here in Oregon. And in order to get there, it seems fairly reasonable that we should ask lenders to be realistic about the ability of borrowers to pay that they should offer the lowest cost loan that's best for consumers, not based on making sure everybody gets a piece of the action and getting a cut wherever and however is possible. And that dealing with prepayment penalties, the testimony of the businessman previously was very compelling to hear. We don't need prepayment penalties because it's fascinating to try to understand why you would punish people who do the right thing, improve their incomes, try to make the fiscally responsible choices about managing their debt, and make them pay for it. Finally, the disclosure of fees, costs, rates, and all prepayments is critical. And I think we could also, as it was another issue on another bill, the private right of action for consumers is incredibly critical. The state has an opportunity to do something very meaningful, and even just joining the other 30 states that have followed the Bush administration's lead on some regulations. I think it sounds like we can go further, and the AFL-CIO would certainly like to do that. We've done that in a number of other states where they've passed fairly aggressive regulations on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Appreciate both of you coming forward with your testimony from your organizations. It's very reassuring to hear people are paying attention to this stuff. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
So next up, I'd like to bring up Keith Carnes and Sybil Hebb. Flip a coin or just start speaking. Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Keith Carnes. I'm an attorney at Olson, Olson & Danes here in Salem. I represent almost exclusively lower-income folks who have disputes over credit issues. A lot of that deals with mortgage lending issues. It also deals with credit reports, which I think is a key factor when we talk about the mortgage business. As a bit of a background, I know that we all know this, but homes are different. We've always treated them as different, whereas if I default on my car, they can just send down any old guy with a tow truck and take it. With a home, it's recognized that you have to go through a 120-day process to foreclose on a home. The need to protect home ownership is very important because it gives people security. It's the one appreciating asset that most people in Oregon will ever own. And it's their single greatest expense. This will take up nearly half of most people's income just to make their home payment every month. And for those reasons, they need to be protected. A lot of discussion in some of the groups I've been in discussing these issues has kept referring to other types of lending, saying they don't do this in the car industry, they don't do this in the credit card industry. Homes are appreciating assets. And when a homeowner doesn't make their payments, they end up losing all the equity that they've built in their home. Now, the lending industry has done a very good job of explaining how they have losses during a foreclosure. However, these are losses of things that are paper losses. It's losses of the inability to collect late fees and interest. It's not actually money that they expend to recover these homes. They're selling them on the market, and they're receiving a profit off of these homes. The homeowner, or the home loan market, is different than any other type of market. One of the major reasons why is because when somebody goes in to get a home loan, before anyone can intelligently tell them what sort of loan they could get them, they will have to look at their credit report. And every time that a mortgage broker or a bank pulls your credit report, your credit score lowers. In fact, for those of you who have bought or done a refinance or an acquisition of a home or any other financing, usually one of the things they'll tell you is don't apply for any other credit, and that will keep your credit score from going down, and therefore we'll be able to get you the best loan possible. So all the idea is that the market will ferret out the best loans isn't really true. If I go out and I apply to 10 different mortgage brokers because I want to find out who's going to give me the lowest yield spread, If I want to find out who's going to give me the best interest rate, I'm going to be lowering my own credit score by doing that, and therefore inhibiting my ability to get the best loan possible. Additionally, when somebody's acquiring a home, there will usually be a whole contingency of home ownership going on with it. For instance, when my family decides to sell our home, we're going to make the sale of our home contingent upon the purchase of our next home. And so when you're getting into the closing time, usually there's the contingency of my home and my home ownership of the house that I'm purchasing tied up, but there's also the buyer who wants to move into my home. And it can go all the way down the line, depending on how far up the food chain you've moved and the size of your house and the value of it. This isn't a process where you can just say at the closing, never mind, forget it. Because you can quite literally create liability for yourself, saying, you know, I already agreed to sell my house. I agreed to buy this house. Now that they're adding things in at the last minute, now that they're changing the terms when we're at closing, it certainly would be great to have that explained before closing, or at least at closing. But when I decide to back out at the last minute, I'm creating liability for myself. And I maybe have already sold my house and have an agreement to do that, that I either have to back out of, or I have to pack my family into an apartment until I can do something else, which creates great burdens. This isn't just regular financing. This is far different. This is the acquisition of the person's greatest asset. And so for those reasons, home loans are different. The market is different. It's not just like shopping for a car where you just look at all your options and pick. Your credit score is lowered when you go out and you shop for a home loan. So for all these reasons that have been discussed, I believe it's very important to have a private right of action. The Oregon Constitution has recognized that there needs to be a remedy for all wrongs that are committed. Giving DCBS the power to fine or assess penalties against mortgage brokers or bankers or anyone else who commit violations is certainly better than nothing. However, that doesn't compensate a borrower who has been done wrong. The Civil Rights Act, going back several decades, acknowledged that there's people who have disparate power, that there are folks who just don't have the ability and the finances to combat those who do. And so for those reasons, as a part of the Civil Rights Act, they passed attorney fee shifting statutes, where those who have lower income and fewer assets can have their attorney fees paid for those who they have to litigate against, assuming that they prevail. And so not only is it important to have it remedied, but I believe it's also important to have an attorney fee shifting provision. These litigation can be expensive, and because of that, that's where some of the real behavior changes happen. It's not lost on me as a trial lawyer and as a plaintiff's attorney who gets my attorney fees paid by the other side that I have the ability to change something. That when somebody is doing something wrong, when a mortgage broker is out there writing bad loans, knowing that there's no way this person can pay this, they're on a fixed income, and in 2 years from now they can't afford their house, it's not lost on me that I can change that behavior, because their motivation in writing these loans is to get paid. And the way that you motivate a change in that is by taking money out of their pocket. Writing legislation, you know, is helpful. Putting DCBS in charge of monitoring is helpful. However, in a financial industry, the only way that we can really change behavior is by doing it in dollars and cents. And the ultimate threat that needs to be there is that you're going to be looking a jury in the eye of 12 folks or 8 folks or however many and explain to them why it is that you ripped off this old lady. And as a part of that need is the part to have an attorney fee shifting statute. I firmly believe that. Thank you for your time.
Sybil.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. I want to first just thank you all very much for your time and attention this evening to this set of issues. They're very important to the Law Center and to our clients. As many of you know, we represent low-income Oregonians across the state. Unfortunately, over the last year, we've seen a rising number in requests for our services for matters related to foreclosure. The great bulk of our clients facing these troubles are seniors who have been in their homes making payments regularly for a long period of time and then who have gotten stuck, bewildered in refinancing negotiations that have left them really at great risk of losing their homes and their security and, as Mr. Kearns mentioned, their most significant asset. So for these reasons, we're supportive of the principles underlying Senate Bill 1090 and appreciate your attention today. I wanted to raise just a couple of key points that we think are the most crucial, namely just the principle that it's not only good policy and common sense, it's the right thing to do to make sure that loans are issued based on a person's ability to pay at the time of the signing of the loan, and that that assessment is done based on the true costs and fees associated with the loan. And we think that that's one of the primary portions of the bill that can help protect people and keep them from facing homelessness suddenly and unexpectedly. I'd like to share with you one example of a client of ours who recently illustrated exactly why this is so necessary. This is an elderly client who was on a fixed SSI income, so it was very clear that her resource every month was a set sum, very minimal amount. And she had owned her home since the early 1970s and had made payments regularly for 30-plus years. She 2 years ago was lured into a refinance loan in which she became responsible for payments that were fixed for a short period of time at an affordable rate, but that became variable after a period of time. She did not understand that. It was very clear from the outset that she had limited income, that there were no other assets, and it was very clear from the outset that these payments were going to jack up very substantially in a short period of time. So there was a lack of disclosure and a lack of explaining of those fees, but there was also a lack of offering the loan based on her true ability to pay. And so we think the disclosure of fees and costs associated with loans is a very important element, and that assessment of a person's ability to pay is very important as well. Wanted to also mention that we think that brokers should have an affirmative duty to offer the lowest cost loan, the highest quality loan that is available to that buyer and that lender has available. As Mr. Kearns mentioned, the buyer's ability to shop around is limited because it results in a reduction of their the variability to negotiate a loan in the first place. So having that duty to make sure to offer the highest quality loan is very important. Also, the limiting of points and fees, including prepayment penalties, is helpful to make sure that people don't get trapped in loans. If their credit becomes better and they want to renegotiate, prepayment penalties often keep them in a spot in which they're unable to do that, and that's not ends up putting their homes at risk as well. Echo the comments about enforcement mechanisms, agree that DCBS regulation is very helpful, but private right of action ensures that there's access to justice for individuals across the state, and it's not dependent on agency staffing and agency ability to investigate, and we believe that that's an important enforcement mechanism and that it really helps implement the structure that that might be provided. So we appreciate the committee's attention to all of these issues, and we do are very supportive and look forward to remaining a part of the discussion about this, and hope that that the various technical questions that have been raised don't serve as a barrier to action on these issues.
So. Thanks. I got a question for maybe both of you, or you know, given the I guess I'm not going to call it a hypothetical, but the case you just mentioned. Where a client or somebody that's on Social Security has an obvious fixed income, you know, and Mr. Kearns, you had mentioned that, you know, we need to have a private right of action and hold, you know, the mortgage broker responsible for putting people into these loans. You know, and from previous testimony, I'm trying to figure out, is it the mortgage broker's responsibility for that particular case, or is it a lender that follows through with actually making the loan and, you know, actually does the underwriting? I mean, from your legal perspective, do you divide those, or, you know, do you treat the mortgage broker separately than the lender itself, or do you just lump them together? I mean, how do you figure out who's responsible, I guess?
Well, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong with having more people looking at this instead of less, and having more people responsible to make sure this is done right instead of fewer people. this is particularly important in today's economy, where a lot of lenders are filing bankruptcy and are becoming insolvent. The question is, who should bear the loss? And if the homeowner is doing everything that they can do to make sure that they're getting a loan that they can afford and they're having some misunderstanding or maybe even misrepresentations, then certainly having more people there to help bear the loss is more valuable than having fewer. And so for those reasons, I think that the whole chain should be responsible to make sure that these loans are being done right.
Representative Galizio.
I have one short question for Mr. Carnes. Did you do debate in high school or college?
I didn't.
Didn't, okay. Just because you sound like a debater, and it's great. That's meant as a compliment, which is good. My question is, in terms of ability to pay at the time of the loan, and also the notion of the highest quality, the best loan, with the myriad circumstances that exist in people's lives, do mortgage brokers have the resources to make these subjective judgments? And then is there any kind of criteria that we could set up? So, I mean, it just seems like those are very difficult. I don't know how you make standards for those.
Chair Holvey, Representative Galizio, and members, I can offer a brief thought and defer to Mr. Carnes' comments as well. But I think that the essential aspect is making sure that the borrower is aware of which is the loan that is the lowest cost loan, making sure that the person that they're, if they're qualified for a loan, making sure that they're offered the loan, the lowest cost loan that they qualify for. I'm sorry, apparently I can't speak anymore. I was not a part of the debate team either. But so I think that that's an objective standard. It's what's the lowest cost loan I can get you into that you're qualified for. There are other loans. You choose which one is the most suitable one for you based on your circumstances and your scenarios. And you may choose to enter into something that costs you more at the outset but maybe gives you a longer period of time or a shorter period of time and is less expensive at the end. And maybe you can save me here from mumbling, but that's the concept.
Well, no, I, Representative Polsey, Representative Galizio, I think that that's accurate, that we can come up with, anyone can figure out what's the lowest cost loan. The question about can they afford the loan, these are questions that are being answered already. I think the issue is, no lender is going to lend to somebody who can't afford the loan at the onset. The question is, can they afford the loan when it's fully adjusted? Now, for instance, my brother-in-law, who's, heaven forbid, a second-year law student, he can sell the loan broker, I'm going to be a lawyer in a couple years, if everything goes right, and I'll be able to afford more than I can now. And so there would be a reasonable expectation that he can afford more in 2 years than he can today. However, those who are on fixed income, we don't expect that a 70-year-old widow is all of a sudden going to be able to pay twice as much in 2 years as you can now. And so we're just saying do the calculus at the beginning like you've always done, but do it again after the loan adjusts. They're already doing the calculus. Just do it when it's a full adjustment rather than at the inception of the loan.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do they get by this through the underwriting? Because you have a certain criteria, and if it's an FHA, you have a certain criteria that you must meet. How does this get through the underwriter to be okayed if we know doggone good and well you have someone that has a fixed income, that they're on an ARM, which maybe they shouldn't be on an ARM because that's usually a short-term type loan, that's going to ratchet up on an index? How do they do that? Isn't that in violation of government guidelines? And my next question, I guess there's two questions here. Wouldn't they be susceptible to being brought up on charges of defrauding the lender themselves if the mortgage broker is either gun decking or changing something that's non-verifiable? I mean, I'm curious to how this gets by the underwriter.
Representative Holvey and I'm sorry, Chair Holvey and I'm sorry, I don't remember.
I'm Representative Esquivel.
Representative Esquivel. The answer to your first question, quite frankly, is I don't know. You'll have to ask the industry why it is that underwriters are approving these loans. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, and I don't know why they're approved. To the second question about are they liable, certainly they're liable. One thing that's happened that we've seen in recent phenomenon is that somebody who defaults within the first few months of the mortgage, the person who originated the loan has to actually buy it back out of the market. And so a lot of these folks have actually been heading into bankruptcy. And so the issue is that these loans are getting approved. They probably shouldn't have because there's been some stated income or something that the broker's done that may not be outright fraud, but you know, maybe hinges on the edges of ethics. But these loans are being transferred back to the originators, and a lot of those folks have headed into bankruptcy and are insolvent. And so there are some mechanisms for handling that. However, these small businesses who are, you know, small compared to these large Wall Street institutions, these large national banks, these small institutions can't handle receiving these loans back, and they usually fold quickly.
So you don't know?
I don't know how you do
that. Okay. He was on the debate team.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments and certainly your weighing in on this. It's good to hear, you know, other opinions. I'm sort of curious about, you know, listening to you. I would assume that you would think loans that require no documentation or verifiable information around income or assets, around the ability to pay the loan, essentially, that you would think that would not be a good practice or something that that we shouldn't allow.
Chair Holvey, I agree that would be a correct statement of what I think.
Mr. Chair?
Me too.
See,
Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, and I disagree with that adamantly. I'll tell you why. Because no doc loans fit some people. Portfolio loans fit some people. One size does not fit all. You have different circumstances for different people. Let's say today, in the state of Oregon, you have 2% foreclosures in the market. Because I think it's 1.4, 1.5, whatever it is. I think Corey told me it was 1.4, 1.5, something like that. Let's not get to the point where we penalize 98.5% of the population for doing what's right while we're trying to protect the 1.5%. Let's be very careful here. And I'll tell you what my concern is, especially with these subprime, because that's what we're talking about, B-money, high-risk loans. My concern here is if we shut that down to the point of where people still want to own a house, they're going to end up in a private lender, which we have no control on whatsoever, a hard money lender out there that's going to charge 12, 14% on today's market. Let's be careful, is what I'm saying.
Further questions?
Questions for Representative Esquivel?
This is an informational hearing. I mean, he obviously has some information.
He has some opinions. Sal, with regard to the no-doc portfolio loan, I mean, how many of those are being made, you know, in the subprime category?
You know, I don't know. I have done them in the past, and the reason being is you have 4, 6, or 8 LLCs. You have a bunch of information to get together for a lender. It's just easier to do that. You pay about a half a point higher on the points, on the interest rate. Sometimes it's as much as 5/8 or 3. I see everybody's out here is nodding. But it's so much simpler to do that. And in our particular case, we can handle it quite well. The big criteria there, I think, is your credit score. If you have a good credit score, that gets kind of into the not only no doc loan, but also a portfolio loan where you have assets, where you have ability to pay it back, and your credit score shows you what your indebtedness is. When you pull a credit score, it'll tell you every piece of credit you've ever had in your life, practically. It'll tell you which ones are open. It'll tell you which ones are maxed out. It'll tell you which ones, how much indebtedness you have. And I'll tell you what, you glimpse at somebody's credit score, and you can tell exactly what they've been doing for the last 20 or 30 years. And those are very prime piece for some people. They are not good for other people. But I'm saying is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwash.
I apologize, but if we're talking about just subprime lending, folks who are, you know, buying their first home or refinancing one loan, I would say that there would be a concern. If we're talking about, the owner of several companies coming in and saying, you know, I'm good for it, you know me, and my credit score is high and I'm paying all my bills, I think that is a different situation. Where, you know, just referring just to the subprime lending, I think it is a problem. I think that there is a place in the market for no-doc loans where there are people who have had a long lending history and, you know, things of that nature. I'm sorry, I was focusing just on the subprime issue.
Right, and I'm not sure, whether we're talking, you know, I'm kind of thinking in the realm of, you know, the homeowner-occupied, you know, type of mortgage specifically. And so you still think that there's those situations where no doc loans and are appropriate?
Well, sure.
In subprime.
Non-owner occupied rentals. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Well, it's certainly. Now I know why they don't give you a nameplate.
Well, I certainly appreciate the silence now, but I really appreciate your comments and your testimony. It's really, really helpful to get this perspective. And I don't see any other questions for you right now. I hope you follow this subject matter a little bit further in this process to see where it goes. So with that, I think I'm going to move on to a couple new folks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Brett, excuse me if I get your name wrong, Reichel, and Matt Georges. Thank you, and identify yourself for the record and speak on.
My name is Matthew Georges. Just a consumer.
My name is Brett Reichel. I am a branch manager and senior loan officer at Pacific Residential Mortgage in Clackamas, Oregon. If you will, I'll go first, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you, Chairman Hovey, and the rest of the representatives and senators on the panel tonight. As an informational thing for mortgage lending, I've been in the mortgage business or real estate business since 1979. I know I look much younger than that, but I've watched many markets come and go. I've watched underwriting standards swing from tight to loose, from loose to tight. I've seen foreclosure crises come and go. And let me tell you, the early 80s were a very difficult time, as were many of the years afterwards. My major concern with proposed legislation for the state of Oregon would be that we not limit options for financing to the degree that we exacerbate the problem we have. I don't believe our problem is as bad as other states. We were late to the party in appreciation. And as a result, we didn't have quite the run-up. We didn't have the speculation that some other states had. And I believe that we will have problems with foreclosures. And I do believe that we are paying the piper, and we will be paying the piper. But I don't think it's going to be as bad as the pictures painted by many people. One of the things that was mentioned a moment ago that I do want to address before I get into the rest of my notes here. It was mentioned that credit inquiries, if you shop from lender to lender, you'll lower your credit score every time, which is not true. If you check with the credit repositories, which are Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, they'll tell you that they compress credit inquiries for mortgage companies for a certain time frame so that multiple credit inquiries are much like one credit inquiry. Same concept as when you go down to when you go down to McLaughlin Boulevard in Portland or Gladstone and you shop for a car, you can stop at five or six dealerships on a weekend, run your credit multiple times. It will not affect your credit score negatively to have multiple inquiries. If you wander to the mall and you shop through the mall and inquire at every store, that will have a negative impact on your credit score. Please verify that with the credit repositories, but that's what they've explained to us as mortgage professionals. The consumer does have the opportunity to shop amongst mortgage lenders. Now, some mortgage lenders may unscrupulously tell people that don't shop because it'll screw up your credit score, but that's basically not true. One thing that's interesting, you know, about our business is there were literally thousands of options. There's probably hundreds of options now, or maybe 50s of options, but one size does not fit all. That was mentioned a moment ago. One loan does not fit all. We have to have the flexibility to help people in the situation they're in. We have to help them buy their first home. We have to help them out of financial difficulty. We have to help them in anything they need, paying for college, remodeling houses, whatever. That's our role in the process. Of course, we're for-profit businesses, and we're here to make money on the transaction. If we're long-term business people, we're not going to slaughter the sheep. We're just going to share it. In other words, that's kind of a harsh term, it sounds like, but it's really a case of developing continued business as opposed to raping one particular consumer. I'm totally against the rape of consumers, and I do believe there needs to be some consumer protections added to the mortgage industry. One thing that you should note is we disclose at application to the borrower. We disclose interest rate, annual percentage rate, amount finance. We disclose itemization of amount finance. We disclose adjustments. We disclose a number of things, prepayment penalty at time of application. It is my belief that by rule of law, we are required to disclose any changes during the process. And we also disclose again at closing. The borrowers have been disclosed. Now, some of them are hoodwinked by, as was mentioned before, bad actors. But a borrower should know what they're getting because they're disclosed multiple times. And a borrower should have some personal responsibility for their actions. There should be some personal responsibility in the transaction. If there's not, there won't be a lender willing to do loans because then who's to say the borrower would ever have to repay? I really believe the department that regulates us needs some teeth. That would be one area that you could help us out in, give us some teeth so that they can actually fight the current scoff laws. An example of a current scoff law would be in this weekend's Oregonian. Two major home builders, with their in-house lender, one with a nationwide lender, advertised in huge, bold type below market interest rates. Contrary to federal law, they did not disclose the rest of the items they were supposed to disclose in an advertisement where an interest rates it disclosed. If they're willing to contravene federal law, if they're criminals on that type of item, they will be criminals with consumers. Please give the department the teeth that they need to fight this type of thing. Another thing that's concerned me about a number of the legislations that have been proposed, bills last year, bills proposed this year, are giving me, as a loan originator, responsibility for decision-making. I don't, as a member of a protected religious group or a minority religious group, I feel that that is kind of the slippery slope everybody always speaks of. And the reason it's a slippery slope is if I have personal responsibility for my borrower's likelihood of repayment, and if I have personal liability, then prejudices can sneak in and color my decisions. It's much better to have that black box, that automated underwriting system, make that decision, or that underwriter off in the silver tower, the ivory tower, who can make that decision without regard to race, color, religion, sex, all the things that most people are protected under fair lending statutes. Things like yield spread premiums, prepayment penalties, documentation variances, these are options, as Representative Esquivel mentioned, that are important for consumers and important for them to have. Yes, it's important to protect senior citizens from predatory lending. Maybe someone on a fixed income getting an adjustable rate mortgage has been mentioned. How about the senior citizen, though, who chose the adjustable rate mortgage because it was a lower cost option for them? And they're planning on selling in 3 or 4 years. What about that consumer? If they have to pay a higher price for a fixed-rate product? What defines ability to repay? Who defines that? What is the definition of that? What defines the lowest cost loan? Is it lowest fees, lowest overall cost, lowest interest rate? What defines highest quality loan? Again, these are questions that are very serious to all of us as we consider these things, because it creates all sorts of problems for everybody in the process. And I believe if we're not very careful, we'll limit up options for financing, and we'll take a problem that we have and make it much worse and create perhaps a real estate crisis here in Oregon. Mr. Georges came along with me. I helped him with the loan a few years ago. And you can ask him questions about the loan. Mr. Georges is... came into town from California. He was one of those mythical California buyers. And he got a job working for his father in Oregon here. He was referred to me by his brother, who's a realtor. And he started working for his father. He was working in the landscaping field. And he could not provide me documentation of a recent previous history of working in that field. So we couldn't count any income from his father's job, even though he was working for his father. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac rules require a 2-year history for someone working with a parent or a family member, and so he didn't have that. So he would have been precluded from home ownership. He decided to go and pay the extra on a no documentation loan, because once he found out about those rules, he didn't want to commit fraud and apply for a loan under false pretenses. So, you know, he could have probably gotten away without telling anybody, you know, he was working for his father, but he didn't want to do that. So he took the no documentation loan. In discussing options with him, he chose a prepayment penalty. Why would he do that? Why would that make any sense? Well, it would make sense for Mr. Georges in that circumstance, because he had 2 years to wait till he qualified for a regular loan, and with a 2-year prepayment penalty, he got a lower interest rate. The lower interest rate lowered his cost for housing in those years. He chose to pay no loan origination fee or points, but to allow me to get paid by the lender through yield spread premium, because that lowered his upfront cost. So a lot of the things that have been bandied about as negatives for the consumer actually were positives for Mr. Georges, and that's why I brought him along, because I thought you might enjoy hearing from him how those things benefited him.
Before you go on, I'm going to jump in with a little question just about the yield spread premium, because
sure.
You kind of piqued my interest there just a little bit. Again, I'm still trying to get my hands around
sure.
that. And you've talked about, you know, the disclosure and all that happens. So in your working with Mr. Georges, did you disclose what the costs of that yield spread premium were?
Yes.
And so is there an ability for that yield spread premium to change?
Yes.
And I guess where I'm going with this is, you know, and you probably disclosed that change to him again. I'm just guessing, but do you think there, you know, that should be a requirement that yield spread premium should be disclosed, and perhaps to take it a step farther, should there be an agreement of what the cost of that yield spread premium is to the consumer, and that you wouldn't be able to receive more than that from the lender without having a new agreement or a new disclosure?
It's an excellent question. In the state of Washington, that is the rule. So all of those of us who are licensed in the state of Washington already live by that rule. If we can live by that rule there...
That is not the rule in Oregon, currently.
It is not. If we can live by that rule there, perhaps we can live by that rule here. You know, it does limit our opportunity to make additional funds. But we, at that point, we do have... And I mean, personally, I want to look out for my clients. I don't believe that... I don't know that that's written in law anywhere. I don't remember seeing that. But I do try to look out for my clients' best interests. So perhaps that would be something that might be considered as an option. Maybe, you know, maybe that's something the governor's work group could consider.
Well, I just bring that up just, you know, for the fact that you made a statement there would limit the amount of funds you could get, but you know, only if it would only limit the amount of funds you could get if your consumer, your client, wouldn't agree to it.
Well, yeah, that's kind of exactly right, and it would eliminate maybe perhaps a windfall gain.
Right.
One of the issues that you're going to face in a circumstance like that, though, is when we get our interest rate sheets every morning from the various lenders, they have discount, which all of you are probably familiar with. That's what everybody talks about as being discount points, which is mm-hmm. supposed to lower the interest rate. A yield spread premium is the opposite of a discount. It's a premium discount. So you get a little bit more if you charge a little bit higher interest rate. Those always are not the same numbers every day. It's not like an eighth and a quarter and a three-eighths and a half. It's more like, you know, 0.1063 one day and 0.2347. So it's going to be difficult to get exactly the same thing. Maybe limiting it to a similar range would be a good thing. So.
Thank you. I had to get that out before I lost track of my ability to say it. So.
Representative
Esparza,
please.
Oh, Representative
Esparza. Mr. Chair,
bouncing all over the right here.
I thought that mortgage brokers were required to disclose all proceeds that they received. Evidently, that's wrong. I would hope that we would stitch that up in the state of Oregon because I know realtors are required, I don't care what you get, you have to disclose that in writing to the client in the contract. And I think what's good for the goose should be for the gander as well. Now, having said that, I think the real problem I see isn't so much with the mortgage brokers getting monies that people don't know about, but did you know that some of this stuff doesn't apply to banks? That's what's interesting. They don't have to disclose, and I think that's just wrong.
Right, I'm about ready to call DCBS again, but I won't right now. So,
can I comment on that?
Sure.
Representative Esco, I hope I didn't lead you to the impression that we don't have to disclose that, or my comments didn't. And if I did, I apologize. It's my understanding we have to disclose everything. So at least from the courses I've taken on it, what our compliance team at our company tells us, what the state tells us when they come through and audit us, we are required to disclose all of that as a mortgage broker. But as a banker, we are not required to disclose service release premiums, which are different than yield spread premiums. But they're essentially the same thing. They're just called different things.
And the reason, let me carry this a step further, the reason banks don't have to disclose that, I'm not sure if that's true or not.
It's true.
That's because we don't regulate them.
No,
because they're federally regulated, but we do regulate some state chartered banks. So,
well, I worked for a state chartered bank a number of years, regulated by the state, and we weren't required to do those. And I believe the concept behind that is the fact that the bank is lending their money. And when Pacific Residential Mortgage, we're a mortgage banker and a broker. When we act as a bank, we're lending our own money. Maybe off a line of credit that we have, but we're lending our own money. We don't have to disclose what we sell that loan for. That's not if we sold that loan and we get a servicing release premium, that's not a matter for the borrower to know about because we're selling an asset of ours, which is the loan. And the same is with the banks. That's my understanding of the concept behind it.
And that doesn't have a residual cost to the borrower?
A residual cost?
Or, I mean, eventually doesn't, I mean, that cost that you're incurring or that premium that you're getting, you know, it seems like the borrower is the one that's actually paying for that.
The borrower is negotiating rates and fees at the beginning, correct. And if there's a large yield spread premium or a large servicing release premium, then, you know, that's built into the cost of the loan over the life of the loan. Hopefully it's used correctly and the borrower's paying a fair amount. But it's transparent with the broker.
Mm-hmm.
It's not transparent with the banker or a banker, like a community bank or a mortgage bank.
But at the same time, that premium could change and that's where we get into problems sometimes when if a new disclosure isn't made or there isn't an agreement that this is what it's going to be, I'm not going to get paid any more than that. You know, it seems like that Washington may be onto something there.
Perhaps.
Don't know, though. But further question, Mr. Georges, would you like to make some comments? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Reichel asked me to come here to talk about my loan that I got. And like Representative Escoville, he mentioned earlier about doing a credit check. And I had excellent credit. And I grew up here in Oregon. I went to California for a number of years. I had to come up here to help my father out with the business. And I wanted to buy a house. I had the money for it. I had the credit for it. But because I didn't have that two-year history, I couldn't get a loan. The only thing I qualified for was the no documentation loan. Mm. And for me, it was perfect. It didn't bother me at all with the two-year prepayment penalty because it was able to save money on my interest rate. And all in all, it was a perfect loan for me. I was able to make my payments. I knew what I was getting into. I understood everything. I knew what I was making, what I couldn't afford, what I could afford. And also with that, I had to come up with the money, a 5% down. So I really knew what I was getting into because I had to put down a good chunk of change. It was over $10,000. So for me, I knew what I was getting into. It was a perfect plan. The only plan, I wish I could have got something better, but for my situation, I was able to get a house, and it worked out for me and Mr. Reichel. So, I mean, it was a win-win situation for me.
Mm-hmm. Representative Galizio.
Yeah, thank you both for coming, Mr. George. So what was the yield spread premium on the loan that you got?
You know, I don't know. You have to ask my wife. My wife did a lot of it. I just signed my name, but I don't know.
Can I follow up?
She should be here.
Yeah, she should.
What was the cost? What did you pay for any kind of discount on points or anything like that?
Oh, man, I don't know. I should know all that, shouldn't I? I don't know. Are you talking about what I put down for the house?
No. Did you pay to discount for the interest rate? Did you pay down to, you know, point to lower
my
the
interest rate?
My
interest rate was 8%. I don't know if that answers your question. I should have brought my wife. I'm
That's
sorry.
All right. All right. No, you shouldn't have dragged her here. That was a very good choice. And you're, but can I? Can I?
Sure.
I mean, this is...
Reichel.
Mr. Reichel, I don't know how many, you know, loans that you've done in your lifetime or even in a week, but I would assume that you do very many, and you know the vocabulary the way Senator Bates can talk about the human body and the system that those of us who are not physicians, we just don't know. And so when you talk about sort of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, I think everyone is sympathetic to that there is personal responsibility. One of the difficulties that I'm having is, even for a relatively well-educated person, the vocabulary is so different. You're at a major advantage to the average person who maybe refinances, I don't know how many times, but you do this all the time. So it's complicated, and so I think one of the things I'm struggling with is not wanting to, you know, people have to take responsibility. But wouldn't you agree that it's fairly complex, and understanding all the terms and the vocabulary and the emotional decision means that there have to be real safeguards to protect the consumer? Would you agree with that?
Well, you know, one of the problems that we run into in the business is mortgage slang. Like any business, I don't know what business you're in, Representative. Is it Galizio?
This, yeah. Look at this.
Political slang, I'm lost on. So, mortgage slang is a definite issue, and it can, you know, I can talk pretty well, talk pretty fast. I wasn't on the debate team, but, you know, I can confuse somebody. Absolutely. I try not to. I try to break it down into very simple terms, and I believe that's one of the reasons for my longevity in the business is good communication skills. In defense of Mr. George's, he bought his house over 5 years ago, and it would seem unreasonable to expect him to remember what his closing costs are or what his yield spread premium was, because I've bought a number of homes and I couldn't tell you what any of those items are. So, I do believe that Oregon is light on consumer protection laws in general, period. And there could be some that would be beneficial for Oregonians in the home buying process. One of my favorite things, my pet peeves are with prepayment penalties, is I absolutely despise a prepayment penalty on a subprime loan that is 3 years long if the loan starts adjusting in 2 years. that is reprehensible to me. And there is no excuse for a lender putting something into that product. A prepayment penalty should make financing more readily available, and it should make it less expensive. That's the only function it should serve. If it doesn't serve either of those functions, it doesn't belong there. But, you know, I mean, that would be one place where I would think the state of Oregon could make a difference in the lives of consumers. Hopefully, we'll see some other things that help solve some of the subprime crisis. On the federal basis, they're trying to improve the FHA home loan program. If they do that, that's the program that about 70% of the subprime buyers should have been on. But since it required a down payment and subprime loans didn't, even if you presented them that option, which is an excellent option, many of you probably bought your first house with an FHA loan. I know I did. That particular loan, we wouldn't even be having this discussion. Unfortunately, the other product came available. I don't believe that in our lifetimes that product will ever be available again. It's much like the Federal Reserve and inflation. Having lived through the 70s and 80s, nobody who's lived through that time frame in a position of power ever wants to see that again. I think the next time we'll see a swing like we saw of loose underwriting will probably be when all of us are dead and gone, because all of us are going to remember it, not want to go through it again. That doesn't mean we don't need some protections for consumers, though.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question. You were talking about the down payment. Do you happen to know what percentage of subprime loans were for refinancing or for initial purchase of a loan?
I don't have that information at my fingertips.
What's your sense on that? I'm not asking.
My sense on most of the subprime loans made over the last 2-3 years, my sense of it is that by far the majority of them were zero down purchases, the 80-20 loan, and it was for people with bruises on their credit, and the goal was to improve their credit. Hopefully that was the goal.
Thank you.
Just a Senator Westman. Brett, I really appreciate your testimony, and I get the fact that there are borrowers that need a targeted, honed, customized loan. You know, having said that, there are still issues that we have to address. Hey, I understand, Matt, that you don't know your yield spread premium.
Thank you.
And it's not fair to put your wife in that position because she doesn't know it either. This is coming again. And you were alive for the last one. I mean, we went through the savings and loan meltdown credit. We went through that, and that was, 25 years ago. So this is coming again. It's a question of credit, too easy credit, hot housing market, avarice and greed. Doesn't mean you're greedy. I'm not saying that. That's what we're looking at. And that's our responsibility, sitting behind this dais as public policymakers. And it's a difficult task. There aren't easy answers. Anyway, thank you.
Waving again.
Mr. Chair, the senator brings up an interesting point here, and what it is, we all saw the movie The Perfect Storm. Well, this is actually what we had in the housing market. In Southern Oregon, we were accelerating a minimum in 4-year time, a minimum in that county of 17.43% acceleration of value, on up to 22% per year. Just do some quick math at 20%, 20%, 20%, and 20%. Well, we got stupid, because you could see this train wreck coming. Because at the same time, here the Fed's dropping this money and dropping this money and dropping this money. And I believe, I was told, I don't know how close this is, but we dropped our prime down to the 1950s level when Dwight Eisenhower was our president. The perfect storm. When the market goes down, this goes up, especially for people that are on an adjustable rate mortgage. It's going to get them. And sure enough, that's exactly what's happened. But I recognized this 2 years before it happened, because it had to stop. We had to quit being stupid with the acceleration of value. And I knew the feds couldn't keep that down to a level of 1950. So that's what happened, and that's how we got here. This will probably happen again someday. If it's another 50 years, probably not to me, but it will happen someday. I know it will. The 80s was due mostly to inflation, runaway inflation. We had double-digit inflation for how many years? A couple of years there. In those days, in 1982, 83, in those days, you were very thankful to get a 14% loan or a 16% loan. I mean, that's just the way it was at the time because of the inflationary problem. It's going to happen again, folks. We need to get rid of the bad actors. But more importantly, we need to work with the federal people to get rid of the bad actors that we don't control. That's your servicers. And that is your predatory foreclosures. I think we can do something with predatory foreclosure people in this state to regulate them, to make sure that they do not come into this state and do a number on people, because that's exactly what they're doing as we speak. As for the servicers, which is a secondary market, you know, and, I mean, you know what a servicer is. Once Wells Fargo or whomever gives a loan over to someone, I've got a real problem with these people, and I'll tell you why. What they're doing is criminal. They will, in fact, service the loan. Wells Fargo is still the originator of that loan. They turn it over to these people. I had a case in Southern Oregon where these kids called in and said, we're going to miss a payment. We were just as nice as can be. No sweat. I'll tell you what. You do it for 6 months, and you pay a sixth ahead, no problem. We'll oblige you. Now, let me tell you what they were doing to these kids. Not only at the end of 6 months did they pay that religiously, and they thought they should be even, but they owed more than the original payment because of penalties and fees. Fact. The second thing was they wanted to negotiate. The servicer wouldn't negotiate. It's not our loan. They went to Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo didn't even have it in their system, because they had turned it over to the servicer. These kids were stuck in the middle of some place where they couldn't negotiate with anyone, nor could they even talk to anyone about their loan. Criminal. That is criminal. Now, what was real sad about this situation is that these kids, during that 6 months, went into what they call forbearance. They didn't even know it. For 6 months, the servicer had been dinging their credit. So when they went to get a refi to get out of underneath that servicer, their credit was so bad they couldn't get a loan. Now, the real thing that I've told Congressman Walden is, I think if you follow the money, you'll find out that on foreclosures, the servicer is the one that gets the money for the foreclosure. Those are the kinds of people we really need to go after. Those and predatory foreclosure people.
Comment?
Please. Regarding the savings and loan crisis, that was a terrible time. I worked at United Bank, which was a mutual savings and loan in Tacoma, Washington at the time. And the big issue with savings and loans, there was two major issues, or maybe three. The number one issue was deregulation of savings and loans. They then experienced disintermediation, which was they had to pay higher interest rates for deposits than they received on their assets for their loans, and they started hemorrhaging cash. As a result, many of the with deregulation, along came many predatory CEOs who bought corporate jets and
congressmen.
I don't know about that, but they bought corporate jets, and they bought Renoir for their boardroom, things like that, and there was a lot of laundering of drug money through those companies, and there was a lot of fraud, and a lot of savings and loans were initially set up as a building and loan. I mean, you remember the old movie from Christmas where Jimmy Stewart helped everybody into a house, and that was what savings loans, they were housing lenders. They stepped into the commercial world. They overbuilt commercially. They didn't know what they were doing. They goofed up. We might see something like that again. Perhaps my estimation of 50 years was excessive. But I really believe that you know, there's usually some hotshot young guy. I'm not that guy anymore. Some hotshot young guy who's going to show everybody on Wall Street how everything works. They're paying the price now. And really, to blame our local people, our local banks, our local mortgage brokers, people like that, I think is there are a few of us that are people who should be punished and who should be put out of the business. But you can see where the problem lies when the CEO of Citi, the CEO of Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, they're losing $15 to $20 billion in mortgage write-offs. They designed the loan programs. I didn't design the loan programs. Nobody here designed those loan programs. They brought them to us. They said, tell the public about this. The public came to us and asked us for the loan programs. I think perhaps we need some restrictions on some things. I like the idea of restricting prepayment penalties to a degree. And perhaps, you know, maybe we need some due diligence with people, whether a fiduciary responsibility is what we need, because I think it's a little bit more in depth with a fiduciary responsibility than we've been discussing. But, I don't envy your job.
Let me follow up just real briefly, because we're really burning up some minutes here. But I want to go back to that prepayment penalty, because you've made a different case for limiting prepayment penalties. And I just kind of want to, I've heard the discussion about prepayment penalties in subprime mortgages. And, you know, you brought up a point that, you know, when you have an adjustable rate, and to me, whether it's a subprime or a prime adjustable rate, where does a prepayment penalty need to stop? I mean, it seems like after the rate adjusts, or even close to when the rate adjusts and afterwards, the prepayment penalty really shouldn't be there anymore. And I can understand having a prepayment penalty in the first year or, you know, whatever, the first, you know, part of the loan where you're getting basically a subsidized lower rate, and so if you refinance, the lender isn't going to, you know, have covered his cost because he's offering you such a low rate. So a prepayment penalty to make up to him so he covers his cost. I think that's the theory. But once that loan gets into that reset time frame and beyond, it seems like there really shouldn't be a prepayment penalty after that, from the way I look at it. I was just kind of curious whether you think that's I'm sort of trying to read what you're thinking, and whether that makes sense to you, whether it's a subprime or a prime loan. I mean, for any loan that adjusts, it seems like to me that ought to be the case. Can you comment on that?
I can. I'd be happy to. One of the things that probably gets confused for folks is subprime loans are typically adjustable rate mortgages. There's prime adjustable rate mortgages and subprime adjustable rate mortgages. An adjustable rate mortgage oftentimes can be the most affordable loan. Obviously, they can adjust downward as well as up. Very rarely will a subprime loan adjust downward. And most subprime loans have a floor of their start rate. And most of the time, they're going to be increasing. So I personally think a subprime loan is a stopgap loan. And it should be available for the borrower the opportunity to get out of that loan into something better. Perhaps, you know, it's a loan to help somebody who's lost a job and they just got a job, but they had some credit problems while they were in the job loss thing and medical bills or who knows what. But I really believe that a prepayment penalty should not go beyond the adjustment date. Period. So if you have a 2-year adjustable rate loan, the prepayment penalty should be no longer than 2 years. And I would not have a problem with stating that it should be 1 year. So the person has 12 months to find another solution. I don't necessarily personally think that would be too burdensome for the industry. I'm not a fan of prepayment penalties. I try to avoid them at all costs. But if it has a benefit for the borrower, I believe the borrower should have the option of making that decision on their own. And the only benefit I can see is lowered cost.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment.
Senator Westland.
And I know the hour's late, but Brett, the rest of the story that you accurately told, where some of the big investment banking houses, you know, heads rolled, those CEOs lost their jobs. They left with 8- or 9-figure golden parachutes. Mm-hmm. Foreign nationals came in, bailed those companies out, and yet thousands, speaking nationally, tens of thousands of American homeowners lost their home, are in bankruptcy,
and a tremendous amount of equity left the pockets of the middle class. That's wrong. And we've got to do all we can to stop it. And granted, it's National Bank problem, Oregon problem. Anyway, I just had to throw that in. Because, yeah, these guys lost their jobs. You know, they left with more money than all of us in this entire room's net worth is. A hell of a way to get fired. Billy Bob and Sally Sue are out on the street. Something the matter with this.
Thank you, Senator. I know you're passionate about that, passionate enough, and everyone knows you're introducing a bill to address some of these issues, and you've got an amendment out on these issues, and most of us haven't had time to really look at the specifics of it, but I'm hoping this informational meeting is being helpful to us to understand this issue and to understand and to help you as well.
Yeah, this is great. I appreciate everyone here.
In your proposed bill and your legislation that's coming from the Senate, I want to keep this dialogue going so we can, you know, because I really am want to do something and want to get it right. But at the same time, you know, the comments, we don't really want to, you know, take loan products away from the market either. And so that's the balance, I think, that I mean, if there's a legitimate reason for a loan product, we shouldn't really outlaw it, in my mind. But I think there's some standards, some parameters we should certainly be looking at around things, lending practices. So, thank you for your
thank you for the opportunity,
your conversation, your testimony, and I apologize if I don't get through this list because we're going to start losing people pretty quickly here, probably.
Pretty soon.
I can see my panel growing weary, and we all have to be back at this here shortly.
We'll set a time limit and we'll try to get through everybody.
So, if people have things to add to this, you know, I'm going to, and if you don't have anything to add that hasn't been talked about, you know, don't, I'm sure there's going to be other opportunities down the road, but I see a couple people that probably want to talk a little bit more, and so I'm willing to stay here as long as somebody else wants to, but I know some others may need to go. But I don't know. I'm just going to read some names here. Ben Todashek, do you have something that you really want to add?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. John Stubenall, come on up.
And before he gets started, Mr. Chair, I really like his first name.
That is a strong name.
Like my senator.
Go ahead and state your name for the record and get right to it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, members of the committee, my name is Ben Todashek, and I'm the director of Oregon Acorn. We're a grassroots community organization. We're also a national organization, and we call ourselves the largest grassroots community organization of low to moderate income family members in the country. We've been around for over 30 years, founded in 1970 in Little Rock, Arkansas, being member funded and run. First, I should say, on behalf of my board of members, thank you for paying significant attention to this issue and giving it the time and consideration it deserves. It's a huge crisis locally and nationally. And over the past 30 years, listening to our members, fighting for their issues, gradually but progressively, this problem has come to be the number one Acorn issue. We have taken on the big corporations that are in finance, such as Household Finance, Wells Fargo, Countrywide most recently, who, you know, are offering these sorts of products that we're here to talk about today. And I mean, I just want to keep this really simple. We've passed laws recently in Minnesota and more recently Illinois. In Rhode Island, I worked to pass a law that were quite a bit more stringent than this law. And one of the things that we always talked about with, you know, hesitant members or hesitant legislators is how every time we pass a law that regulates another state's industry, the if you will, shady interests in that industry go to the next state where there's less regulations and start to practice there. An example of some of the more, you know, stringent guidelines that we've suggested and passed in other states, there's counseling standards somebody mentioned earlier. There's a ban on stated income loans. I could just go on and on, but we have a shortage of time. I also wanted to share something that our sister organization in Portland, Acorn Housing, asked me to share. They couldn't be here today. They are a HUD-certified housing counseling nonprofit. Acorn Housing works all across the country with low to moderate income home buyers to help them purchase and stay in their homes. Purely formed out of like the birth of the subprime industry in response to it. And from between 2006 to 2007, their business has gone significantly in the direction of helping people refinance out of predatory loans, as they refer to them, people who are going to be foreclosed on. That's a reflection of the market and a number of different issues. The director of Acorn Housing told me that he pulled the numbers between November of 2006 and November of 2007, 55%. There was a 55% increase in foreclosures in Portland. I think you could look at that as like a poll. You know, it's not going to be exactly accurate, but it's definitely a trend. And if we had had more time, we could put together more significant numbers. Our members are completely for any kind of regulation of an industry that offers incentives to increase the price of products rather than decrease them, such as yield spread premiums and prepayment penalties, which sort of are a perversion of the natural, healthy competition that keeps markets in consumers' best interests. Thanks, and I'll take any questions you guys might have.
Thank you.
No questions right now. We tend to get quieter as the night goes on. Mr. Stuvenall, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, good evening. John Stuvenall, Director of Advocacy at Oregon Food Bank. I'll be very brief. Really like to echo some of the thoughts Senator Westland mentioned earlier about the tremendous drains of equity we've seen through some of these products and in the marketplace in recent years. Public policy should be about people, and from Oregon Food Bank's perspective, a key point here is that we should incent low-income Oregonians and help them find ways to build wealth and to build assets for their families so that they can find ways to become economically self-sufficient. What we're seeing more in the surveys that we do that Oregon Food Bank and our network partners do throughout the state, we've seen a doubling in the last 10 years of the percentage of families who are emergency food box recipients who also report to us that they're homeowners. Now, it's only 24% of the population we serve, but it's a doubling of that population in the last 10 years. So what we're seeing more and more in our state is folks not only struggling to put food on the table for their families, but those are the same folks in many cases who are struggling to keep the American dream of home ownership. So Oregon Food Bank finds many of the concepts that are currently embedded in a certain Senate bill to be very valuable in the sense that these are ways we can preserve equity in home ownership and enable folks to build wealth, to build assets for their families, specifically limitations on prepayment penalties, as you've heard many times tonight, reasonable underwriting standards to ensure that folks can cover the cost, the true cost of the loan, throughout the term of the loan, after the teaser rates have reset. And I think really most specifically, some prohibition on the flipping of loans, where loans are refinanced and churned and refinanced and flipped again, not for the benefit of the homeowner or the borrower, but to generate revenues for the broker or for the lender. We find that especially unconscionable and are very encouraged by the language that's in a certain Senate bill that would address this provision. With that, I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you.
Not seeing any questions flying out right at the moment. Thank you a lot for your testimony, especially the written testimony. That's always helpful. Thank you. And if any of you have written testimony you'd like to submit, you know, please do so. Next up, I have Don Miner, Steve Emery. No, he's not signed up. Mm-mm.
Chair Holby, am I on there? Steve Emery, I'm owner of Pacific Sunset Mortgage. I've been in the mortgage business for 20 years. I chaired ethics committee for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers from 99 to 2004. I am not speaking on behalf of the OAMP, though, but I just, real quickly, I'm going to bullet point this rather than talking like I did last Friday. Just to answer a couple of quick questions. The counseling idea, pre-counseling for certain types of loans is probably appropriate, but as far as all loans or in counseling or recording, I think is very inappropriate and slow down a transaction. I think the representative on the end brought up some very good points on that. I think it defers liability, and I don't think we should defer liability. I think the loan officer should be liable. As far as RESPA and the yield spread premiums, I provided testimony with multiple pages with a lot of explanations on yield spread premium, which I'd be happy to provide to this group as well. But yield spread premium is supposed to be disclosed according to federal law since 1993, and that's part of the Real Estate Practices Act. Exactly how that's defined and how that disclosure happens is what's happened ambiguously over the years. Washington has done an excellent job, I think Brett Reichel mentioned it, Washington's done an excellent job of pinning that down. The Federal Reserve currently has rules in process, which Chair Holby, you were referring to, which is requiring those disclosures be made a lot more precisely, which is excellent. What the Federal Reserve does will apply to everybody. Equal playing field, national banks, mortgage brokers, everybody. It's a wonderful thing. We could also add that into state law. I think that would be a great idea as well. The biggest thing here, just conceptually, we're fighting the wrong war. We're trying to fight. We're going after these underwriting guidelines, which I know everybody wants to do, and the consumer groups think are wonderful and make sense to many lay people. This is the wrong approach. Fiduciary responsibilities, that's the absolute opposite of what we want, and I would be happy to answer questions on that. I'm trying to be quick. What we need to do is quit fighting the last war and worrying about what happened with subprime loans that are gone, because I don't care what kind of legislation we come up with to pass and be specific on ability to pay and income documentation and not this loan and not this prepayment penalty, the industry will just come up with something new that isn't addressed. So instead of going after underwriting guidelines, ability to repay, which makes sense to people that don't understand the industry, which will destroy the industry, and there's only been four or five states that have passed those type of laws, and they've all passed recently, like in the last 12 months, and those states are decimated worse than us. We've lost 40 to 60% of our employment in this industry, and these states have lost a lot more. Products have gone like crazy. Instead of doing that, there's things we can do, and I'm going to mention those things, but I'll give you a quick example. I had a real estate office across the hallway from my office that opened up 6 months ago. Three Spanish-speaking people opened up a real estate office called Prestigio Realty. They had been at John L. Scott for years successfully, opened their own 6 months ago. They walked out on their lease Monday and closed because they don't have any more product for their ethnic group that they market to and sell to. The subprime loans are gone, they're devastated, and the community home buyer loans that they were relying upon and some of the FHA loans are so much harder to get, they closed shop and walked out on a lease. They signed it, I don't know for sure, but they had to sign at least a 3-year lease. My building won't do less. So these guys closed because there's no products for them. You know, we're losing products. We're hemorrhaging in this industry. I would like to see the Oregon legislator help the industry. How can you help? You may say, better loan officers. Registration is wonderful, but licensing is better. I know the department would take a while to get ramped up to that, but let's put in a law and get ramped up. Let's do it. Get individual bonding. Let's get, you know, the national system is going to have national licensing for loan officers. Why not? There's already, I think, 17 or 20 states that do it. Why can't we do that, too? You know, let's get rid of those bad players, bad apples. Better mortgage companies. I'm going to agree with the attorneys. I don't know if they're still in the room to an extent.
I think we need to have more responsibility for mortgage companies, and the only way you're going to do that is to increase our bonds and require errors and omissions. I'm a small company. I have 5 employees. I pay for errors and omissions. I'm in business. I'm quite successful. I can afford the errors and omissions. I can afford a $100,000 bond. Okay, what good is it to have private right of action or any type of penalties from DCBS, the division, if all I have is a $25,000 bond? There ain't enough to go after. I mean, one consumer's deal one time loses out on that. Better disclosures. YSP disclosure, I think, are critical. I think it's horrible that banks don't have to disclose SRP. I think it's horrible that there are mortgage bankers that do loans as a mortgage banker and don't have to disclose SRP, and mortgage brokers do loans as mortgage brokers and don't. But unfortunately, that's federal law. And there's not much we're going to do about that. Let's let the feds, because the feds are working on that, let's let them kind of come up with something that does apply to everybody. Hopefully it'll be better. I think a fraud notice signed by a consumer at application. We have it. It's in. You've all seen probably the 4-page loan application. Right above the signatures, there's a little box about this big with tiny print that says all this stuff about fraud and title this and title that if you commit fraud. There's a form that the FBI came up with, that the mortgage bankers came up with, that is this big, big seal, says mortgage fraud is investigated by the FBI. Why don't we just simply make everybody sign that application? I think that'd be a wonderful disclosure. Will it solve all the problems? No. We can come up with some non-traditional subprime disclosures to meet federal guidelines. I've already come up with them for my company because technically those products, you were supposed to have done that already. Yield spread premium is disclosed out to the nth degree to 3 decimal points at application. My website, I have it on my website with examples, details, everything, to exactly what it is. It's always disclosed. I think getting the DCBS more people and more enforcement officers is a great idea, because you're not going to catch any, you can make 100 more laws. If you don't have anybody, you know, if there's nobody, no cops on the freeway, we're all going to go 80 back to Portland tonight. You know, you need to have some people out there to catch the people. And with Dancer, one more thing for Representative Bonamici, the Cook County, Illinois thing with the counseling stuff, that was the governor of the state created an emergency order, which is online, and I think I've provided it to some of you last session. Where they created an emergency order to repeal that because the consumers of Cook County were in rioting just about because they couldn't get home loans because they all had to go for 2 weeks of counseling and go through all that, and they hated it. So the governor passed a emergency order and canceled it. Though the shame of it is, there is a legislation in the Illinois legislature with that exact same bill, and all they did, you can see it online, they lined out the word Cook County, and they're trying to make it pass for the entire state, so I don't understand that. But I'm done.
And I'm going to go first this time.
Okay. Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Your prerogative.
You know, I'm just going to play devil's advocate with you just for a minute, you know, listening to, you know, you said a lot of great things, and, you know, the yield spread premium being required to be disclosed, you know, because I get different information, you know, some people say it isn't, some people say it is, but essentially, and we talked about that, and I don't want to beleaguer that too much, because I think we've gone through that yield spread premium enough for one night. But just your basic concept of, you know, well, you know, we really don't need this ability to pay to, you know, regulate the industry further. We're already beaten up. We're damaged. We're hurting. You know, it seems to me that maybe if we had some of those parameters around, you know, the mortgage industry to start with, that maybe we wouldn't have gone in, we may not have made as many loans, you know, at some point, but had there been some regulation, maybe the mortgage industry wouldn't have gotten into this huge problem now we're just going down the other road, you know, where everybody's laying off because, you know, they just stopped the product because they realized, oh, these products really weren't fiscally responsible, and so we're going to stop making them, and it dries up the market, and now we have a lot of mortgage brokers and realtors and home builders and a lot of other people, and I might add, you know, sawmill workers and everything else that are getting laid off. You know, because this whole mortgage industry has just, you know, gone crazy making loans that people couldn't afford.
causing this huge foreclosure crisis. So I recognize what you're saying to some degree, but it seems like if we did have some regulations, some parameters around this, that maybe it wouldn't have been such a hard hit to the economy overall. I don't know. Can you respond to that?
I can definitely respond to that, Chair Holby. It's a conceptual thing. I will respectfully disagree that that is the approach, because, again, I think a lot of the problems happen with a lot of the people. Our industry went from like 30% of what it was to 70% growth in a two-year period, and a lot of bad loans and bad loan products came into play. Those bad loan products aren't going to come back. Different ones are going to come back. So my point is that you shouldn't be making additional state-mandated 50% debt ratio full document type mandates, which may sound like they make sense for a good chunk of people. It won't work for about 30% of the people that we've done. And maybe those people shouldn't get homes. And maybe you're right, and the whole country will go to this concept, and my entire industry will change. It'll change my broker agreements, how I do business, and everything else. But that's what it'll take. It'll be a major infrastructure change. But I oppose that way, because I still believe that a good loan officer operating at a good company that does the right thing by the consumer will do a good loan. And that loan officer, talking about fiduciary, you don't want him to be a fiduciary. And this gets to fiduciary. You don't want him to be a fiduciary. I think that the loan officer getting in too tight with the customer is partially why we're in this problem, too. Because that loan officer said, well, I can't get approved on a 30-year fixed. Hey, but let's go state it on this, you know, two-year fixed product at interest only, and I can get you in that house that you can't afford. We want to separate that officer. We used to call them loan officers. In fact, at my company, we still do. Because an officer of the company makes a good loan for the company and makes sure it's a good loan the consumer and customer can pay back. We need to get more back to that responsibility concept. And if we have that responsibility concept with enough insurances to get rid of, to let those attorneys sue the bad players, I'll trust a jury of my peers to say whether or not I did the right thing, and let me say my part, and the attorney can say their part. And I think the guys that are doing the bad things will not be able to defend themselves. So strengthen the industry, strengthen our responsibility, strengthen our liability, strengthen DCBS to come after us, and I think you'll fix the problem. Not completely. You'll never get rid of the crooks. I mean, there are other states that have very stringent laws. I'm from California 15 years ago, and I was fingerprinted and background checked and everything else. I moved to Oregon and got it. I didn't even have to have a license. It was amazing to me.
But you're stopping short of saying we should put requirements in to require you to make fiscally responsible loans.
I think you should not do that, even though on the face of it, it sounds reasonable. I'd have to take about a half an hour to explain to you the nuances of why that will destroy loan products even more so than they are, and take away more financing options and start closing more and more prestigious realties. So no, I can't.
I'll take you up on that half hour, but not right now. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See if I remember my question. First of all, I'd like to thank you for not using the term bad actor, because Representative Gillen gets a little cranky when that term is used, because
he should.
Which is a good thing. And secondly, is that you'll probably beat me back to Portland because I'm not driving 80. Could you please explain, and I almost hesitate to do this because Chair Holby said we've discussed this enough, could you please explain precisely what it is that Washington does that's so much better than what we're doing with the old spread premium disclosure?
Sure. Washington makes a loan officer, quote, at the beginning of the application, the yield spread premium as a percentage and a dollar amount of the loan amount on, let's say, a hypothetical transaction. Let's say my consumer comes in and wants to borrow $200,000 on a house loan, and I want to make a point and a half. I may tell that consumer I'm going to charge them 1 point origination, which would be $2,000, and I'm going to charge them a half point yield spread premium, which is $1,000. There's my 1.5%. When that consumer then goes and buys a different house and a different thing, I cannot charge more than that 1.5%. Just can't. Okay, so I think that's an excellent idea and an excellent rule. They also make it, you have to disclose it, the percentage and the dollar amount, and they both have to be in the 800 section of the good faith estimate. Now, here's the best part. This is not a Washington state law. This is federal law. Washington just defines it clearer, more precisely, and puts it in their statute, which makes it very easy for their DFI, Division of Finance and Insurance, to go after the mortgage brokers, which they do very clearly. In our state, we don't define it quite as clearly, so Barry Leslie has a very hard time going after a mortgage broker that doesn't disclose. Because what the mortgage brokers here wants to do is say 0 to 3% interest rate premium. Well, that's just not appropriate. They should be disclosing it down to three decimal points, yield spread, dollar amount, everything, not charging more. I wish we could make the banks do it too, but we can't.
Yep. Well, maybe someday. But and I just want to reiterate that. I mean, I found it in the Federal Reserve proposed rules. Their proposed rules on the yield spread premium describes essentially what you said.
I think they're going to end up pretty much where I'm at.
Yes. And the point, though, you're making is that nobody's been able to confirm to me yet, and I've asked some officials about this as well, is will these rules apply to everybody in the state of Oregon? And
the Federal Reserve rules?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, and I've had some say they will, and some say they're only going to regulate who the Federal Reserve already regulates, the federally chartered institutions.
Every loan I sell, Chair Holby, goes through a federal institution, and they all end up in federal institutions. Matter of fact, we named some names here. Countrywide wasn't it mentioned. They're a division of a federal bank.
My question is, do all loans go through?
I would say 99.9. Probably not all, because there's some privately held companies that do their own thing. But I would say 99.9. If what the Federal Reserve does will affect the entire industry. Part of the reason we had a collapse was because of the federal rules of the federal guidance on non-traditional mortgages, which was in 10 of 06, and then the subprime guidance, which was in June of 07. Those bills caused the secondary market collapse of August 3rd, 2007. I'm going to be very precise, because those went right in order and boom, the market collapsed, because those rules required us to do underwriting by the fully indexed rate. Those rules required the lenders to be more responsible to the brokers and watch the brokers. I was very much in support of those rules, and I think those are great rules, but they're guidelines, but they're in essence law. When the federal agencies tell their banks and their people, we recommend you do this, they mean you do this or we will shut you down. So they do it.
Thank you. Well, it's always hard to tell how fast the federal government will move.
Very slow.
Any other questions?
Just a comment on Mr. Emery's basic position, which is, and we've had long discussions about this, his premise, which I think is a good one, is that the most fundamental thing we can do is improve the quality of the broker or loan originator sitting behind the desk. And you do that, you know, with errors and omissions, LO licensure, you know, enforcement, give Corey Shop enough teeth that they're thinking, yeah, this someone's going to be coming by. A couple of bricks and sticks, you know, physical location. Improve the quality of the loan officer. That's part of where Mr. Emery's coming from, and just so everybody knows, those amendments are coming as soon as LC can get them out. So this is an ongoing discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Miner.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time at this late hour. My name is Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. I've represented those folks down here since 1979, so I've seen this is the second time I've seen this, although I'd agree that the first one was different than this. I can tell you that the manufactured housing industry hasn't engaged or made very, very few what you would consider subprime loans, if any at all, in the last 6 to 8 years. But there was a time. For about 30 years, this industry enjoyed about 28% of the single-family housing market. And it was discovered in about the mid-90s by the lenders as this wonderful opportunity. And before you knew it, there were more lenders than you could shake a stick at willing to finance manufactured homes. And they bid the underwriting criteria down, rates down. They weren't called subprime loans. It was just called aggressive lending in those days. And that all came to an end in about 1999 or 2000 as what we called step loans adjusted upwards, and folks couldn't afford them. And defaulted. We grew an industry from about 28% down to about 9% of single-family homes. And we haven't shaken it off yet. The lenders are still extremely restrictive in their underwriting criteria. They impose loan penalties on manufactured homes. Don't know if it'll ever end. The reason I give you that piece of history is a concern with the definition that's being considered for what is a subprime loan. And as I understand it, both in Senator Wessland's bill and some amendments and otherwise, is that it's a loan that has an interest rate of 3% higher than the Treasury bill rate of a comparable maturity. Now, manufactured homes start out, again, this historic hangover, at least a 0.5% higher than the same buyer with a site-built home would pay. So to kind of level that out, when you're talking about a manufactured home transaction, it shouldn't be a predatory loan until it's at least 3.5% above. And I passed out a copy of an alert looks like this that we received from our National Association, where Freddie Mac has decided to bump that up to about 1.75%. And so I've, and those wouldn't be discount points paid by the consumer at the front end, as I understand it, but the lender would have to discount his loan when he sells it to Freddie Mac. And my understanding is that would translate into about 1.25%. So again, to make all things equal, it would have to be adjusted upwards to treat manufactured home purchasers and lenders on an equal footing with other types of lenders. That really explains my concern. I think to do otherwise then will cause lenders, there was an abundance of lenders in the mid late 90s, there's a paucity now, to throw manufactured home lenders into the subprime category, I think would result in even fewer lenders and therefore less favorable financing for our consumers. So that concludes my remark.
Interesting. Sounds like discrimination almost.
Senator Wessland asked me why sell it. They can get it. There's not a lot of competition and they can get it. So.
Questions of Mr. Miner? Thanks for your input on this. Hopefully we can wade through that and take it into consideration. Thanks, and Mr. Emery, as well.
Well, as Don's leaving, we've looked at a portion of the bill. I think his concern is a technical fix. Your concern is the easiest part of the deal.
Okay. Well, I'm almost done anyway, so thanks for staying. Got a few people left, and I'm not sure. Uriah King, are you still here? Okay. Jim Templin?
I'll be real quick if you don't ask me a question.
I'm not going to make any promises like that.
My name is Jim Templin. I own Investors Mortgage Company and Sannie M. Escrow. Sannie M. Escrow is a collection escrow agency, and that's what I'm here about. One of the things that always seems to happen in legislation is the fact that you write a legislation, you write the legislation, and you include people by not excluding them. In other words, by definition of a subprime lender, any private lender would be a subprime lender, and a lot of them don't consider themselves to be subprime. So, what I'm here about is the fact that we have two parts of the real estate industry that have been in existence for as long as Oregon's been in existence, one of which is seller carrybacks. And if a seller sells more than four homes under your definition of the federal definitions that you put into the first law, they would be considered a lender and therefore would have to use the same criteria for qualifying the person that they're selling their home to as on land sale contract or note and trustee as a federal lender would have to use. Well, you know, the reason why people sell and carry the paper back are twofold. One, the property won't qualify. The buyer won't qualify. Okay, or they really like the investment. They want the money. So we would ask that they be excluded, that you actually define that seller carrybacks not be included in any legislation, because that's a prime part of selling real estate in Oregon. The other part of that is under my servicing contracts that I have for private investors, we service everything under the sun, and it's very creative. Okay, and it works. And I will tell you quite honestly that the default ratio for my company in the 35 years that we've been servicing private paper is less than a percentage point in any given year. We don't have people pay people. Okay, and we don't have a foreclosure ratio, but these people that are out there, the private investors, I'm sorry that Mr. Escoval isn't here, because we get into arguments over. What we want to call predatory rates or whatever, but they get paid for a risk, and they earn a risk, but they're not in the foreclosure business, they're in the lending business to keep the economy turning. And I think that when you write these loans, when you're writing these legislations, that you keep in mind the fact that there is a large percentage of the population of Oregon that helps other people buy property. And they're private lenders. There's people who have seller carrybacks. There are people who just simply like to invest in real estate as a lender, not as an owner. And they keep the economy going. You have to remember them in this legislation. In your definitions, they should be excluded. That's where I'm at.
So is the seller carryback like a land sale contract?
Yeah, or a note and trust deed. If I'm going to buy your house and I have a down payment and you're willing to sell it to me, you may do it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I don't know, not in the room before, but have bought their first homes this way. I bought my first home from the seller, mm-hmm. and he carried the paper, and it allowed me to build my credit, to build my equity in my home, to refinance later, and to grow. That's how it works, and you can't call these people subprime lenders. Okay, their rates are a little higher because we haven't got the credit to pay for it. And if you make them have to qualify these people by their credit, it says here in this thing, it says that they're qualified because they're by their credit, because you're going to give them an interest only loan or whatever, so they have to have good credit. If good credit was a criteria, a lot of people in Oregon wouldn't be able to buy homes.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the people that I'm servicing.
Yeah.
And they're good buyers, and they're good sellers, and they're good lenders on the other side.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's a part of real estate I might have forgot, because I bought my first home on a land sale contract. So
that's where I'm at.
I'm not sure how that fits into this.
We forget to exclude them, okay? Yeah. And I'm not sure that's the real thing, because we're controlled by the consumer finance. We're controlled by the securities division. We have our regulations and our sets, but they shouldn't be included in this kind of legislation. That's my own opinion.
Yeah, I don't really have an opinion on that yet. So,
what was your yield spread premium?
I didn't even know what a yield or a premium or a spread
was.
Right. So.
That's all I have to say. I just wanted to make you guys all aware of the fact that this, in all the legislation that's coming about, there's a segment of the industry that you guys have to keep to remember, and that's the private. They're there.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding us.
Thank you.
Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, well, thank you for waiting, too. Might have been important.
No, I learned a lot. And the longer it got, I thought, hell, it's my time, too. I'm going to give you 2 bits in.
Well, good for you. Thank you very much for your perseverance. Boy, we're almost there. Carol, Hannibal?
I'll be brief. That's what they all say.
Yeah, I've heard that 20 times.
I have a son whose basketball practice ends at night, and I trust you. Trust me, I will be brief.
We hope you're from Salem.
Yeah, I know, and it's a good thing. But don't
worry. Or you can go up the freeway with Steve at 90 miles
an hour. I'll follow the speed limit, because I really enjoy my good driving record and my good insurance rates, which is a nice segue to what I want to talk about. I'm Carol Hannibal.
Thanks.
My husband and I own Meridian Mortgage Incorporated here in town. We've been in business since the year 2000. He has been in the industry since 1996. We have lived in Salem almost forever, but not quite. I actually worked in the gift shop here at the Capitol when I was a student at Willamette University across the street, and we have a long-time commitment to this community. But I don't really want to talk about that, because none of that is really pertinent to the subject at hand. What is pertinent to the subject at hand is I did read the bill last night. I faxed copies of it to my bonding company and to my errors and omissions insurer, and asked them what impact, if any, if passed, this legislation would have on my ability to have a mortgage broker's bond, as required by state law now, which is a good requirement, and be able to carry errors and omissions insurance, which is not a state requirement, but helps to protect me and, by extension, protect the consumers that I serve. I basically got told that they probably would pull out of Oregon. That was what my bonding company told me, and they're a national bonding company. And they're actually one we switched to after several other bonding companies that we've used throughout time have withdrawn from Oregon from this market. My errors and omissions insurer didn't get back to me specifically, but did say that I should probably plan on my premium doubling. My current annual premium at this time for a policy with a $100,000 limit, which would maybe partially take care of one borrower, is about $4,500 per year. So I guess what I'm saying is the responsible broker who carries the proper coverage and more than is required will be eliminated from the Oregon marketplace if some of the portions of this legislation are passed, specifically the fiduciary duty that becomes imposed on the broker, and also the treble damages were the two things that my bonding company got a little excited about. Excited is a bad thing in the insurance industry. I know this because I'm a chartered property casualty underwriter and had 10 years in insurance before I entered lending. So I'm about as stodgy as it gets. And insurers don't like exciting, nor do they like change, nor do they like exposure. And when they see it, they withdraw from markets if they stay in them at all. They become very expensive. So that's one area I wanted to address from a risk management standpoint. What will happen if you eliminate brokers as a business channel for consumers who want to obtain a mortgage loan is you will probably find that the companies that are outside of this legislation and are outside of the legislative and enforcement reach of Oregon will not have to be as accountable to Oregon consumers because the annoying little broker that is the small town face, the office to whom they can come and see, where they can talk to the owner and get mad at the owner if the owner has done something wrong, will have vanished. And instead you will have the large faceless corporation with the call center in a foreign country who hasn't got any accountability and cannot be found to redress wrongs done the consumer. So the broker channel is the one of the checks and balances that makes lending affordable for consumers because we do it at a lower cost, on a smaller frame, and locally where a lender needs to operate nationally. And they have a responsibility to their shareholders. They don't have a responsibility necessarily to individuals in the community that they serve and make money from. So, and I'm not saying I'm a not-for-profit, although some days it does feel like that. But brokers are brokers because they want to serve the local community they're in. They want to be independent business people, and they want to serve people in a way that is reflective of what the community wants. So that's pretty much it. One small note about prepayment penalties. I hate them. I'm also not a big fan of chemotherapy, nor am I a huge fan of radiation. However, having had my husband have cancer last year, he's in remission now, we're pretty stoked about that, also having had health insurance, but that's a whole other story. I'm much more in favor of second-degree skin burns than I was prior to last April. And what I'd like to say concerning prepayment penalties is, for a borrower's financial life, a prepayment penalty may be the thing that helps them save their house. Last Friday, my borrower that I'd started working with in October saved his home. His ex, and I can't give his name, and I wanted him to come, but he had to go to work. Happens. But basically, his ex-girlfriend with whom he bought the home moved out, left no forwarding address, never made any of the payments on the home, resurfaced a year ago, and sued him for her share of equity in the home, which is her right under Oregon law. It was arbitrated, and a settlement was reached where basically the home had to be sold by X date if it could not be refinanced, and she, the plaintiff, get her share of the equity. Were it not for a subprime loan, fixed rate, I might add, with a 3-year prepayment penalty, my borrower wouldn't have felt qualified for a loan to save his home. This was a fully documented loan where the borrower's clear ability to repay was documented. And had he been forced to have a 1-year prepayment penalty, the corresponding interest rate he would have had would have resulted in a payment that would have disqualified him from getting the loan. So all I know is I have a borrower, and he is one of my 2 to 3 examples per year of subprime loans we actually do. The rest of our paper is A paper conforming, FHA and VA. I'd love to talk about what it costs to be HUD approved, but that's a whole other conversation. All I know is he called me and said, God bless you, when he found out his loan had funded and he was going to be able to keep his home, even though he was short, you know, his closing costs and about $29,000 of equity he would have otherwise kept. And I think if we get too stringent on dictating what kind of loan products can be offered, it's not going to hurt everybody. Most everybody will still be able to buy a home, but the people it does hurt will be very severely affected by that. So that's all I had to say, but I would love your questions.
One quick question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
I'm confused. Prepayment penalties on a, I think you said fixed rate loan?
Mm-hmm.
So that wouldn't be a subprime loan.
It is a subprime loan. His rate was 9.06%, which certainly, although I got to tell you, when we bought our home with a conforming loan in 1995, our rate was 9.375%.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything's relative. But his loan is a subprime loan. A subprime lender gave it, and he has a three-year prepayment penalty. It is truly a subprime product. He had 2 mortgage lates in the last 12 months.
But it's not going to reset.
No.
Okay.
No, lots of subprime loans can be fixed-rate loans.
Right.
I did personally originated 3 adjustable-rate subprime transactions throughout the entire height of the refinance boom. The rest of the people I talked into fixed-rate loans saying, I know it's $40 more a month, but what if everything hits the fan and you can't refinance later after your loan goes adjustable? Trust me, this is a good thing. Just don't go to Starbucks and buy lattes. You'll be fine. So, I mean, it's possible to do a subprime loan that isn't going to have the borrower out on the street.
Yeah, and thank you. I appreciate that you brought that point out, because there's so many different kinds of loan products out there. There really are. And that's why when I was questioning Steve Emery, I was talking about prepayment penalties in relationship to adjustable rates. That's the connection I see, not really relevant to whether it's subprime or prime. It's that adjustment that I think is important, and you know, I'm sure there's others with other opinions on that. But in relationship to the prepayment penalty, I think there's a correlation to that teaser rate and the prepayment penalty period. But once it resets and you know it moves on, I think we're talking about something a lot different. I don't understand why a prepayment penalty exists beyond that.
A prepayment penalty exists in order for the lender to have a business reason to do the loan.
Right.
Remember that this is high-risk lending. My borrower had 2 mortgage lates in the last 12 months. That there isn't anything that a mortgage lender likes to see less than that.
Mm-hmm.
We would have loved to do his refinance as a VA loan, for which he was qualified come April, when he would have had no mortgage
rates. Right, but that was a fixed rate. So
right,
that,
no, but we couldn't do his VA loan, a better quality loan, which I wanted him to get, because he had another timeline that was not within his control, and that was the deadline to do with the litigation and settlement. So, I mean, sometimes a borrower doesn't have a choice, which bites, because I could have gotten him a great VA loan, and he would love that, but life happens. So, but the lender makes the loan with the prepayment penalty because they're offering a lower rate than they have evaluated that risk to cost. So if it pays off before a certain amount of interest income is earned, they need to recoup the lost income.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing's true in commercial lending, a lockout period.
Right.
You know, again, because otherwise the true cost of money is just a ton higher, and then people won't qualify, or they'll just exclude themselves from the market, I think.
speaking of life and remission, what kind of cancer, if I may ask, did your husband have?
Heck of a good question. Nobody's really 100% sure on that, but it was a neuroendocrine tumor. Nobody has any idea where it originated. We certainly know where it manifested. And a complete surgical cure was not possible, but as I said, he's in remission, and multiple CT scans and some wonderful nuclear stuff have revealed what we've known all along, which is that his head is empty, at least of cancer. So, knock on wood, it will continue that way.
Salem Oncology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bud Pierce. Good guy. A little nutty, but he's an artist. I can't speak highly enough about the team at Salem Hospital.
Did mine, and the best.
Yes, I would agree.
A little bit off topic, and, since you are the last testifier we have signed up, I really appreciate you coming forward, and even though you were last, you still gave us another little bit of information.
Yeah, exactly.
And, I really appreciate you coming forward. I think this has given the committee members, especially that have stayed here and have to get up and be here first thing in the morning.
You guys are the best sports in all of
them. So anyway, I really appreciate everybody. And Jim, I apologize for running you this late. Did you get dinner?
What? I'm getting paid a lot more than you are.
Okay.
So.
Oh, dinner.
That's fine with me. Don't remind me. But anyway, Senator Westland, any other comments?
I'm afraid to ask. There's a narrative.
Y'all through with me?
We are. Thank you very much. Here, I thought I had exhausted my list. I didn't see Shane Jackson on here.
He's not signed up. He didn't get to testify.
Would you like to say a few quick words?
Maybe just share an observation.
Yeah.
Jim,
anybody
want to
wants to go
again?
Ahead and leave,
Sybil,
they
want
can.
To testify so. Again?
I don't,
what
do you mean,
Eric,
anybody
Mark?
There's,
what the hell?
We were supposed to be out of here at 9 o'clock, I'm breaking some sort of regulation, probably.
Could you stop talking so we can finish?
Oh, okay. I call you out of order, but you're right.
Thank you,
thank you for this opportunity, real quick. There's
Jackson
one.
Jackson for the record.
Oh, yes, for the record, Shane Jackson, lobbyist for the Oregon Coalition of Mortgage Originators. Many of my clients were speaking here tonight. I want to thank you for this opportunity for this informational meeting. I want to share a really quick observation. As you heard tonight, as we talked about products, it just got deeper and more nuanced and more complicated. As we talked about actors and actions, what we're referring to during the night, bad apples, there was overall consensus and durability in our cure for the problem when we focused on professionalism. And so I think I would really appreciate if we would look at professionalism as a direction that we're going to look for curing our issues. And I tell you, if we focus on products, we're just going to continue this dialogue in a very circular fashion. I'd just like to share that observation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for that and summation. Any other comments from the legislators that have been sitting here?
Great testimonies on both sides of this issue.
I thought it was good.
I appreciate the individual who said, I don't envy your task.
Hmm. Yes. I don't envy yours or mine or anybody else's, really. But thank you very much for those that are left. I really appreciate it. I think this will help in me. Maybe it got more complicated for a lot of people, but it did help my understanding quite a bit. So appreciate the input. With that, seeing no other people wanting to talk, I'm going to close the informational hearing.